You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It's my great pleasure to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Ellen Schrecker. Ellen Schrecker is a retired professor of American history at Yeshiva University and is a leading authority on McCarthyism. Her books include Many Are the Crimes, McCarthyism in America, and No Ivory Tower, McCarthyism in the Universities. Ellen Schrecker, it's a very timely topic. Welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you very much, David, and it's a pleasure to be with you.
Thanks for coming on. I'm sure as an expert on the term McCarthyism, you see the term used accurately and perhaps misused. Why don't we start with what was McCarthyism?
Okay, well, let's begin at the beginning with the name. McCarthyism was much more than just the wild antics of one junior senator from Wisconsin, Joseph McCarthy. It was really a kind of term that I think most accurately can be described as a rather broad-based, widespread campaign against political dissent. Perhaps it was, in fact, the most wide-ranging and longest-lasting episode of political repression in the United States.
And so that's taking it as something that preceded and continued after the antics of Senator McCarthy?
Very much so. McCarthy was really a figure of some importance politically for maybe 3.5 years. That's it. But McCarthyism as such, this a campaign that in the name of national security, and we have to realize that national security in the 20th and 21st century is often a cover for political repression, a justification for cracking down on dissent. McCarthyism really lasted from the onset of the Cold War until sometime in the mid-60s, although it was petering out by the late 50s. But there were still moments when people were sent to jail for the perfectly legal crime, quote-unquote, of belonging to the Communist Party, an unpopular political party that was nonetheless legal. So what we were seeing throughout this period is a period of accusations of communism, charges that the Truman administration in the late 1940s, early 50s was shielding communists in government. Now, one of the reasons that McCarthyism, this form of political repression, was so powerful was that it was plausible. There were not Reds under every bed, although at times the sort of general hysterical political atmosphere may have made it seem the case, but there had been members of the Communist Party who during World War II, when the United States and the Soviet Union were allied, did in fact spy for the Kremlin. The fact is that they were discovered, they were outed, and by the late 1940s, there really was no threat, no credible threat of communist espionage in the United States, even though earlier it had existed and, in fact, had been, unfortunately, very successful since it gave the Soviet Union information about the atomic bomb.
And yet this took off after, subsequent to the time when it was a plausible and realistic concern.
And
it took off. It took off, I imagine you would say, not just because of a small right-wing sect, but because of a mainstream popular, if misguided, belief. Is that fair to say?
That is very much the case. Although what's important to realize is that many of the people and institutions that created the scenario of the quote-unquote threat of communism had been active as far back as the 30s, even before that. Probably the most powerful person involved with this anti-communist campaign that we now call McCarthyism was J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI. And if we had known then what we know now about what Hoover and the FBI had been doing in the 40s, 50s, 60s, we probably would have named that phenomenon Hooverism. It's much more accurate. Hoover was really very much involved in creating not just the notion of a communist threat, but publicizing it and also creating the mechanism for implementing it. And what's interesting about McCarthyism and certainly political repression in the United States in the 1940s and 50s is that it operated in accordance with a two-stage procedure. The first stage was exposing people as communists. This could be done by a congressional investigating committee, the most powerful of which was one called the House Un-American Activities Committee, or HUAC. Joseph McCarthy, after the Republicans took power in 1953, had his own committee, and he was investigating. There were a number of similar committees at the state and even local levels, but also right-wing journalists, I guess the equivalent of the Breitbart, perhaps, were spreading accusations of communism. The FBI was secretly leaking information about people, giving information about people's political activities to congressional committees, to governors, to university presidents. So what you were seeing was a campaign first to expose people, and then the second stage after the exposure was punitive, to punish them. And most of the time, this punishment was economic. People lost their jobs and then were blacklisted. The most well-known of these blacklists took place within the entertainment industry, but there were blacklists within the nonprofit sector, within universities and colleges, and it was pretty widespread. The FBI often secretly would inform a employer of that one of his employees, quote-unquote, subversive past. So what you had was an atmosphere where there was a fear on the part of people who had once been politically active on the left, and they pulled back.
Yeah, and there's nobody better at being afraid in this country than liberals. I think when we look back at McCarthyism, we think of it as Republican and partisan and right-wing. You've written about Hubert Humphrey supporting concentration camps for communists. Can you talk about the role of liberals and Democrats?
Sure. After all, one of the main goals, one of the main functions of McCarthyism from the beginning, these charges of communist aversion, were being used in a very partisan manner by Republican politicians who, especially in the aftermath of the 1948 election, when Harry Truman won a surprise victory over the Republican candidate, these people, Republican politicians, began to look for an issue. They had been running against the New Deal and had discovered that things like Social Security were popular. So they had to find something to run against. and they picked up on communist subversion in the government and began to charge the Democratic administration with shielding people who were subversive, charge it with being soft on communism. And the Democratic politicians and people in liberal organizations became terrified. They were afraid that they would somehow be accused of shielding, subversive communist spies or something. So what they did was try to preempt that attack. And so you have, for example, the Truman administration, in the aftermath of the 1946 election, which elected a Republican Congress, trying to protect its rear by issuing a loyalty security program that had essentially been designed by J. Edgar Hoover's FBI. And it was highly ideological. It had questionnaires. People were being asked if they had friends of a different race. This is a period of high segregation within the United States, and communists were among the few groups that, white groups, not civil rights groups as such, that supported racial integration. So you have a very repressive loyalty security program that is essentially creating a political test for employment that's being implemented by the Democratic administration of Harry Truman, who is so terrified of being charged with protecting communists that they want to get rid of them themselves. And you have these kind of purges within a number of mainstream liberal organizations, like, of all things, the ACLU, the NAACP, groups that you wouldn't think of as being repressive and implementing this kind of behavior. But the 1950s was very scary for liberals. I think they've learned their lessons since then. But anyhow, during this whole period, there was a law that was passed called 1950, called the Internal Security Act, or better known as the McCarran Act, named after a senator from Nevada who was very, very conservative and anti-communist. And as this act is coming before Congress, liberals are trying to make an end run against it by proposing even more repressive measures than were in the original bill. Much of the original bill, by the way, had been drawn up by none other than Richard Nixon, who had been a young congressman serving on HUAC, the House Un-American Activities Committee, and had made his political career out of anti-communism. And the bill that was passed required all members of the Communist Party to register with the something called the Subversive Activities Control Board. And it was aimed at all kinds of left-wing activities that were connected to the Communist Party. And it's important to realize, by the way, that at its peak, the Communist Party may have had 75,000 to 100,000 members. Most people went in for a little bit, joined when they were students and left. And during the 19th, it was always unpopular, always unpopular. It was never a threat to the United States politically in any way, shape, or form. But for many young people, idealistic people during the 30s, which was the period of the Depression, of a lot of labor trouble, people looked at the Communist Party as the most effective organization for implementing the kinds of measures that they wanted, like racial equality, like labor organizing, like peace movements, anti-fascism. And so it did have a brief moment of activism. Its members were the most energetic people on the left, but it was not an organization that ever threatened the United States in any political way.
Right.
But what happened with all of these measures, the loyalty security program, the investigations by congressional committees, the charges of Senator McCarthy, together created an atmosphere of fear, of timidity, of pulling back because you could be the FBI might have a file on you. You might have signed a petition to put a member of the Communist Party on the ballot. Didn't mean you were going to vote communist, but you might think that this is a democratic thing to do, that all voices should be represented. So what you had was people pulling back, a real narrowing of the political spectrum.
Yeah. We're speaking with Ellen Schrecker, whose books include Many Are the Crimes, McCarthyism in America, and No Ivory Tower, McCarthyism in the Universities. Ellen, I'd love to turn for a second to this idea that you mentioned, that liberals learned their lessons and they know better now, because I throw out as a possible challenge to that this bizarre situation we're in which we have a new president blatantly, demonstrably committing numerous offenses, including violations of the Foreign and Domestic Emoluments Clauses of the Constitution and other forms of corruption that are just documented beyond question. And for the most part, Democrats and liberals are going after him for unproven accusations, anything they can grab a hold of that has anything to do with Russia, and making friendship and lack of sufficient hostility toward Russia into some sort of treasonous offense. I understand that, you know, the motivation is to claim that Hillary Clinton won the election or would have without foreign interference, you know, that this may be the main motivation. But the result is, you know, this demonization of Russia and this creation of greater hostility with another nuclear government and all sorts of false accusations and hostility piled on with apparent disregard for possible catastrophic consequences. Am I wrong to see McCarthyism there?
It's related. Clearly, they are looking for something that can bring in national security issues where they think that it's strong. It's not. I don't think it's McCarthyism. I think it's kind of silly, but I've been asked this question before, and my feeling is I'm just not well enough informed. I don't know enough, and I don't think anybody knows enough about what was going on with the Soviet Union in the election. Certainly, it's an issue that the Democrats are picking up on, and it's not making American-Russian relations any more, what can we say, peaceful. But I think the real issue and what really bothers me more than that is the fact that what we're losing in this country because of sort of powerful Republican years of a powerful Republican campaign to take over state houses, to deprive people of their votes, to gerrymander congressional districts and at a lower level as well. What we're seeing is a real attack on American democracy that is being run certainly with a lot of corporate assistance, and is using anti-immigrant stuff to sort of fire up a kind of nationalism that could be very destructive. So I'm really much more worried about that than I am about the attempt of the Democrats, who unfortunately at the moment have very little power. You know, let us hope that they will try to use the filibuster effectively when they can. But there's not too much they can do to prevent a lot of bad things happening. So I know what you mean about this being McCarthyism in terms of charges of, you know, collaborating with a quote-unquote national enemy. But I don't think this is the major issue at the moment.
Well, I wasn't making any case what was the major issue or that we should disregard any other important issues. And I certainly am horrified to my core by both of the topics you've mentioned, or the one I've mentioned and the one you've mentioned. But it does seem to me that even in the height of traditional McCarthyism in the 50s, the silliest accusations weren't totally disproven by public evidence. There was the possibility that there was some communist spy in the government. You couldn't say otherwise. I mean, it seems exactly identical to me to the situation now, where there remains the possibility that Vladimir Putin somehow sabotaged the U.S. election. You know, there's no evidence, but the possibility exists.
That's a good point.
On that basis, you know, the same sort of prioritization is taking place of what to accuse people of, which cases of perjury to get upset about, you know, which officials to denounce for treason, while numerous other serious problems and legitimate offenses and abuses are just deemed unimportant.
Right. Well, I agree with you that this is clearly a diversion, but I think it in that regard, it's very much like the communist in government stuff that the Republicans were talking about in the late 1940s.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's McCarthyism as such. I really don't.
Okay.
I think you get, because it's one thing to criticize and demonize Russia. It's another thing to attack people at home. It's another thing to focus on political dissenters in the United States. And I think to that extreme, you know, McCarthyism is sometimes very narrowly defined as making unfounded charges, right?
Sure.
Which is what McCarthy did. But I think that it can't be expanded to include the entire Cold War. I think that sort of deprives it of its explanatory power.
So you're talking about going after dissent
as a form of political repression.
Yeah. And you've looked quite a bit in that regard at what's happening in academia, not just with regard to activists in the streets. What signs of McCarthyism are you seeing in U.S. academia at present?
Troubling moments when, in particular, at least until recently, over the issue of Israel and Palestine, the most blatant violations of academic freedom have occurred with regard to people who have supported the Palestinian cause. And again, we're seeing university presidents, supposedly part of a liberal university world, giving in mainly to pressure from outside funders and groups like that. We are seeing, for example, now there's something called a professor's watch list of, I don't know, some 200 names put out by a right-wing student group that lists professors who supposedly are attacking the conservative students in their classes. This is completely false. Again, another myth. Is it plausible? Maybe. But there aren't nobody's really come up with any cases of that. So, you know, what we're seeing is the whole kind of tenor of political life on campus being ramped up, being polarized, and then leading to attacks on individuals. What's nice, and remember, one of the things about the McCarthy period was how many liberal organizations caved in. Well, the moment that this professor's watch list was created, the main organization of American professors that protects academic freedom, it's called the American Association of University Professors, which in the 1950s didn't do a thing to protect the more than 100 professors who were simply fired during the McCarthy period for refusing to name names or standing up against a congressional committee like McCarthy. The American Association of University Professors this time said, hey, wait a minute, this could be a new form of McCarthyism. So we are going to ask all our members to write to this group and ask to have your name put on it.
Very good. We have just a minute left. It does seem like there is a widespread impact on numerous issues. People backing off on criticizing Israel. People up to and including the president backing off on more friendly relations with Russia. I know of peace advocates backing off on pushing friendly relations with Russia or with Muslim nations. What should we be doing to resist these kinds of pressures?
Well, I think the most important thing is simply to be on top of these issues and get more information. I mean, one of the problems is that there's, you know, as you know, there's so much false news out there that it's kind of hard to figure out what's actually going on, especially with a administration, if you want to call it that, that is busily creating static, you know.
Yeah.
And I think, what should American policy be? In most of the world, not to intervene, and certainly not to intervene militarily. That might be a start.
That would be an excellent start, and perhaps we can get better informed by reading your books. They include Many Are the Crimes, McCarthyism in America, and No Ivory Tower, McCarthyism in the Universities. Ellen Schrecker, thank you very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you very much.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
To Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the White House wants to cut $6 billion from HUD, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, or 13% of the agency's funding. Team Trump says that programs that support affordable housing for families, the elderly, and people with disabilities haven't justified their existence. It's not a mystery how devastating such cuts would be, and for whom, or why. So how do we fight back with a different vision of housing and community? We'll talk about that with Tony Romano, organizer with the Right to the City Alliance. Also on the show, March 20th marks 14 years since the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq. Corporate media don't make much of these anniversaries and still less of their own role at the time, and no wonder. So poorly did U.S. journalists perform their function that research shows those who got their news from TV believed that weapons of mass destruction had been discovered in Iraq, that evidence closely linking Iraq to al-Qaeda had been found, or that world opinion approved of the U.S. invasion. Perhaps the biggest lie now is that everyone believed Iraq had banned weapons because, after all, the intelligence said so. Counterspin talked about that intelligence in February 2004, a year into the war, with investigative journalist Robert Dreyfus. We're going to bring you that conversation today as an antidote to tales about what everyone believed. All of that's coming up, and we're going to get right to it. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. The Trump White House has plans, according to documents obtained by the Washington Post, to cut some $6 billion from HUD, the Department of Housing and Urban Development. Cuts to programs supporting housing for low-income families, for the elderly, for homeless veterans and people with disabilities, for Native Americans. Cuts of millions of dollars each from programs that were already overburdened. That the country faces a crisis of scarcity, and that this means we should take more from those who are struggling, is a bizarre idea that seems to silently undergird much mainstream media discourse. The gutting of programs that keep roofs over people's heads offers another chance to dismantle that idea. But it would require corporate media giving serious space to other different ways of seeing the world. Tony Romano is organizing director with the Right to the City Alliance. He joins us now by phone from Atlanta, Georgia. Welcome to Counterspin, Tony Romano.
Hi, good to be here with you.
Well, let me ask you, first of all, what do you think would be the on-the-ground effects of this kind of financial cut to HUD that we're hearing about? Whose lives are likely to be most directly impacted?
The impact is going to be severe and swift if it happens, and hopefully it won't. There's great resistance. $6 billion from the HUD budget essentially guts HUD. And HUD right now is the only source of housing and funding for very low-income people, people who make 0 to 30% of AMI, which could be like $0 to $15,000 in a lot of our cities. There is no housing that those folks have access to other than public housing or housing where they have a Section 8 voucher. And if you have public housing or you have Section 8, what's very important about that is you only pay a third of your income. And they're messing with that formula a little bit, but that's what it's been, and that's the essence of they pay a third of your income, which means if your income declines, you lose your job, pay less. So the idea is that that's truly affordable housing. And it's not a bad measure to say, generally, if you pay over a third of your income, it's not affordable. Now, of course, we believe if you make under a certain amount, then you don't have any money to put to housing and you shouldn't have to pay any. But with that said, the poorest folks right now in this country who are retired folks, extremely low-wage workers, folks differently abled. These folks, the only homes where they can live are these homes. So if there are cuts, what it means literally is these folks are on the street. $6 billion means the elimination of hundreds of thousands of public housing units and hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Section 8 vouchers. That means those folks are on the street. And if you make $2,000 a year, if you make $10,000 a year, $15,000 a year, there is no place for you to live except under a bridge. So we're talking thousands and thousands of additional homeless people. I'm not even talking about the level of crisis right now. And for the whatever HUD housing remains, there's going to be a whole other level of burden on those residents who will likely paying, you know, a third of their income to paying much more of their income. So we'll see more and more people in HUD housing that don't have affordable rents.
Now, it seems enough to say that that's unacceptable on its face, to be creating homelessness, to driving people into having fewer and fewer options. But in case it needed saying, this also has an impact on communities. It's not to say that if you are not quite yourself right on that edge, that it won't have an impact on the community that you live in, because after all, we're talking about working families, folks who are living in a neighborhood or a city because that's where they work. So the rippling impact is also important here, is it not?
Very true. And we know that gentrification is rampant throughout the country. We know there's an eviction epidemic where thousands of families are being evicted literally monthly in cities across this country. And the one thing right now that allows residents to stay in a community where they've been for decades and decades is HUD housing. The other thing we should note here is we are in the midst of one of the worst national housing crises in the history of this country. So when we talk about $6 billion in cuts, we can talk about the devastation of people who are in HUD housing right now. Right, the thousands and thousands that will be made homeless, the thousands and thousands that will have to pay a lot more of their income to housing and thus not be able to pay for prescriptions or a bus pass. But what we're not talking about is the fact that millions and millions of people, one in every two renters in this country, have unaffordable rent right now. And they're in the private sector. So actually, at a time when we've been pushing the government to step up its role to support the expansion of truly affordable housing, this is what's happened. And it should be noted that it doesn't evenly impact all peoples and communities. So it's Black communities, Latina communities, Asian communities that are hardest hit.
Well, I think part of what Right to the City wants to say and emphasize is that it doesn't have to be that way. So let me just say, you know, it's clear that this move of gutting HUD, this is part of a bigger plan on the part of the Trump administration. You know, we know that the money that they're taking out of social programs is going to fund a bigger military and it's going into private pockets. You know, they have a vision, if you will, you know, and those of us who want something different have to be just as bold with our competing vision. So I want to ask you, what's the new vision for housing? How does housing fit into the vision of the world we want to live in? And what do we need to do to get there?
Great question. And, you know, for us, everything we do is driven by vision and how we feel the world should be. And actually, for us, and regular folks out there, working people, it's not that complicated. Housing and our community are vital to us being able to live and thrive. Without home and without community, nothing else becomes possible, and everything else becomes a crisis. So if something is that important to our lives, it should not be something that's sold on the market like a hamburger, where everything's driven by folks that want to maximize profit. We believe clearly housing, community, land are human rights. And our vision and answer has already been proven to work. our answer is move housing and land to a place where it's fundamentally there to serve people's needs, to have a stable, healthy, thriving home and community. And we've seen that happen. There are places where the land is collectively owned by the residents. Some of the residents are homeowners. Some of the residents are renters. What's unique about those communities is the land is collectively owned by everyone who lives on it. So let me give you an example. If you look at Boston from 2007, the number of evictions, thousands, the number of foreclosures, thousands, the number of people who have lost their homes, the number of people made homeless, the number of people putting most of their income to housing is devastating. If you looked at a map of Boston and there was a red dot for every eviction or foreclosure, it would look like a bloody corpse, except there would be one part that would have no red dots. And you would think it must be a lake, right, or a big body of water because people couldn't live there. Actually, it's called Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative. It's a community land trust that's been there for decades. Because the folks collectively own the land, they have not suffered evictions and foreclosures. And even if someone loses their job, then their rent or their payments to housing, because the land's collectively owned, they work together, right? So some homeowners move to be a renter and vice versa. So it's proven to work when the land is collectively owned. Let me tell you the other thing that's worked. Even if people do not collectively own the land, where people have actually been in a place and been able to be stable and secure and not have a threat of eviction is when they have rent control. Mm-hmm. If people have rent control, then no matter what happens, if there's investment in the community, which people long for, if there's development, they get to help shape and benefit from that development. But of course, rent control is being eroded. So for us, our vision is to decommodify land and housing and to create stability for renters and homeowners. And what that means is, one, renters' rights. So let's expand rent control. How about universal rent control? Mm-hmm. If you're a renter, you have rent control. That would prevent rising ridiculous rents. And then second, even beyond that, for people to start to have direct control over the land through community land trust. What does that mean? It means when the cities, the governments, HUD, Fannie and Freddie are handing over land and properties to developers, we're saying, hey, we got an idea. Why don't you right now put a third of all your land and turn it over to communities to collectively own the land? Right. And then they will decide what happens on that land. And they will foster development, investment, but they will shape it and they will benefit from it. So there's some very simple things that can happen. In terms of our demands were to expand HUD funding. And in terms of scarcity versus abundance, we know there's an abundance. We know the finance capitalists, we know the big corporations, the Blackstones, they are making profits hand over fist. And none of that is going back into folks. So financial transaction taxes, real corporate taxes, that would generate enough money to definitely allow rents to be stable, allow the HUD budget to be significantly increased, and to allow people to be able to live where they aren't paying most of their income to housing and having to literally make a choice of, do I pay rent or do I get my medication? Do I pay rent or do I pay for childcare for my kid? Those are the kinds of dilemmas families are facing every day.
We've been speaking with Tony Romano. He's organizing director at Right to the City, a national alliance of racial, economic, and environmental justice organizations. You can find their work on housing and other issues online at righttothecity.org. Tony Romano, thank you very, very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Good to be here. And if people want to hear and learn more information or get involved in the resistance, you can go to www.homesforall.org, and that's F-O-R spelled out. You can also go to www.righttothecity.org, and you can join. We'll support you in starting to organize tenant unions or community organizations, which are the heart and soul of this growing movement, and we'll also help you connect with existing very powerful resident-led organizations in your area.
All right, then. Thank you so, so much, Tony Romano.
Thank you, Janine.
The toll of the U.S. war on Iraq, following years of devastating sanctions, can hardly be reckoned. At least 500,000 people killed, millions displaced, made ill, their homes and communities destroyed. Of course, the political repercussions in the region and thousands of U.S. service members killed and wounded. All of it based on falsehoods peddled to the U.S. public by warmongering politicians enabled by the press. After months of coverage dominated by pro-war pundits and former generals, Iraqis themselves rarely heard from, many Americans likely accepted the official story that the invaders would be welcomed as liberators in the streets of Baghdad. But vast numbers did not. Millions marched in the streets in opposition to the war before it started. But that viewpoint was sidelined and worse in corporate media, whose current rehabilitation of the author of the nightmare, George W. Bush, is only the latest sign of their eager amnesia about the role they played in leading us to an illegal war based on lies. In February of 2004, Counterspin spoke with investigative journalist Robert Dreyfus about pre-war intelligence on Iraq and the role of a secret and largely unaccountable organization inside the Pentagon in manufacturing and publicizing it. Dreyfus co-authored an article for Mother Jones on the matter called The Lie Factory. This is Counterspin Steve Rendell in early 2004 speaking with journalist Robert Dreyfus.
Robert, when David Kaye announced that he didn't think they'd find weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, he was adamant that the administration was misled by the CIA and that intelligence was not shaped or distorted by the Bush administration. Much of the media discussion followed that same line, but your article suggests that there's a lot more to the story. Tell us a little bit about what you found.
Well, I think the most important thing is that while the CIA probably did not get very much right about Iraq, they were at least convinced, most of the intelligence agencies, that there was a lot of doubt, that there were a lot of things they didn't know. The doubts got completely erased in the policymaking circles, and in particular, the Pentagon, which set up its own little sort of rump intelligence unit called the Office of Special Plans under Douglas Feith at the Pentagon bureaucracy, not only was responsible for deleting these doubts, but they had some value added too. They added in their own spin and their own intelligence, part of which came from Iraqi exiles, part of which came from their own staff, which was doing its own intelligence. And they created talking papers that ended up wildly exaggerating the threat that Iraq allegedly posed to both the United States and to its neighbors. And that information went directly to Vice President Cheney's office and to the White House. And it led the administration in the direction of going to war because that was a war they already wanted. In other words, the idea that they were invading Iraq based on faulty intelligence has it exactly backwards. They had already decided they wanted to invade Iraq. So the intelligence was then used to justify a pre-existing policy. And for Bush to argue, or anyone else to argue, that the administration went to war based on faulty intelligence is just plain silly. They would have gone to war in any case, but they were afraid to make the argument that Saddam Hussein is a bad guy, and therefore for reasons of national strategy, for reasons of oil, for reasons of Middle East policy and protecting Israel, for all these reasons, we're going to invade Iraq. That probably wouldn't have sold either to the American public or to Congress. So instead, they picked on this Iraq is a threat argument.
So, Robert Dreyfus, can I assume that the lie factory referred to in the title of your piece refers to this internal Pentagon Office of Special Plans?
Yeah, it started right after 9/11. Within a month of 9/11, they set this unit up. It wasn't called the Office of Special Plans then. It had a different name. It went from being something like two or three people, and it expanded and brought in contractors and consultants, and eventually took the name Office of Special Plans, which incorporated this intelligence unit. That's what became basically the war planning office at the Pentagon.
And from what you report, they pushed out analysts that weren't going along with the program to some degree.
They really purged anybody who wasn't part of the zealous team of missionaries that believed in the war. These people were forced into retirement. They were transferred to other offices. Some of them just quit in disgust. And they brought in people, ironically, who were not intelligence experts, people who were ideologues, but who were not particularly skilled at either intelligence collection or analysis. So what they did is they took these piles and piles of information with thousands of little data bits, and they picked out the ones that supported the case for going to war, and they discarded all the rest. And any intelligence conclusion is based on evaluating all of the information, a lot of which is going to be contradictory. Some of it's based on forged documents, on lies, on misinformation, on just plain old honest human mistakes. So all of that information, you know, isn't going to agree. And the job of an intelligence analyst or a professional is to look at it all and say, here's my conclusion, and here's the reasons why my conclusion isn't 100%, so I give this a certain percent validity. Well, this office didn't do that at all. They just basically said, you know, we're gung-ho for war, and Iraq is an enormous threat to American national security, and all of the junk that we heard about unmanned aerial vehicles striking the United States and Iraq building its nuclear program and importing WMD-related materials, all of that was a crock.
In your reporting of this, you conducted a lot of interviews, and one that was particularly compelling was one you did with a certain former Air Force colonel. Tell us that about that story briefly.
Her name's Karen Kwiatkowski. She was a lieutenant colonel in the Air Force, and she worked inside the Pentagon in the Near East South Asian Affairs Office, which was where this Office of Special Plans took shape. And so she watched it all week by week taking shape, and she was horrified by it. She is a tremendously courageous whistleblower, in fact, because she's a conservative, not someone who's some sort of fuzzy-minded liberal. She was, however, shocked by what she calls the neoconservative cabal that was shaping the way this office operated, and in particular by the intervention of people like Dick Cheney's staff director, Louis Libby, and others who were tasking or assigning, you know, jobs and missions to this unit, which is highly unusual. It's an office that should work down deep in the bowels of the Pentagon, and here's the vice president's office operating on a day-to-day basis in touch with them.
Robert Dreyfus, at this point, it seems that some very good reporting has come out of mainstream media, particularly from the Washington Post. But some critics suggest that the Post hasn't pushed its reporting to the front page often enough. Even Washington Post ombudsman Michael Gettler wrote recently, quote, make sure you read page A17 or wherever the next piece of the puzzle appears, close quote. What do you think of the priority the media has given to this story so far?
Well, I think it has gotten somewhat lost for two reasons. One is it got lost because the aftermath of the war was so catastrophically bad, with an insurgency and a complete mess and a seemingly completely bumbling administration, U.S. administration over there, that's become the main story. And then second, it is sort of obvious that Bush and Cheney were saying WMD for months and months and months, and we got over there and they weren't there. So what else can you say except, well, we didn't find them and they were wrong? So I think they sort of lost the handle on how to investigate the wrongdoing. I think the core of the problem is the media is unwilling to look at the government and say that there's conscious malfeasance happening. They much prefer to say this was a mistake or this was just, you know, incompetence or conflict of interest or all kinds of other things that are more, easier to swallow than to say that someone was out there deliberately manufacturing evidence. I mean, one of the most obvious cases is no one has really investigated who forged those uranium documents. There's no argument that those documents were deliberately forged by someone. It wasn't a mistake. And finding out you know, what we know about who forged them, and I believe that somebody in the intelligence system here knows, is something that reporters ought to be just leaping into. And I don't see that too many people are even asking the question. And there are other questions like that that I think have just been ignored, and in part, you know, because reporters follow the official investigations, and now there have been several efforts by the Republicans in Congress to intimidate investigations and say, well, there's nothing there. The chairman of the House Intelligence Committee has pretty much said that point blank. So I think to the extent that the official investigations are turning into cover-ups, then I think the media is finding it difficult to get these kind of more explosive charges onto the front page.
You've appeared on Counterspin before discussing Iraqi National Congress leader Ahmed Chalabi and his unreliability. A recent Knight Ridder story points out that, in spite of the fact that defectors and witnesses put forth by Chalabi's INC, quote, exaggerated what they knew, fabricated tales, or were coached by others what to say, close quote, the U.S. intends to continue funding the INC's intelligence gathering. The Knight Ridder story hasn't received much attention in other media now. What are your thoughts on this part of the story? Bear in mind that we only have a few seconds left, Robert.
Well, we're not just funding him. We're supporting him to become the next president of Iraq. I mean, here's a guy who's a long-term historic crook and bank embezzler. Now we know he's also a liar about intelligence, and the Pentagon is still supporting him to become the leader of a nation, never mind a couple million dollars to fund his organization. So I continue to be stunned and amazed that Chalabi has any credibility whatsoever with anyone, although apparently he's been quite a valuable source for Judy Miller at the New York Times over the years. So I guess he's got some friends in the media himself.
That was Robert Dreyfus speaking with Counterspin's Steve Rendell. The article, The Lie Factory, by Dreyfus and Jason Vest, can still be found on MotherJones.com. And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For more information, check out our website, fair.org. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio Eco Shop with Alex Smith. Hey there, here's another mind-rocking show for you. This week I got hammered by some awful news from some great climate science, so I took my troubles to the University of Ottawa climate scientist Paul Beckwith. We get a cutting-edge education. Then we'll try and heal with real food you can grow yourself. Our guest, Caleb Warnock, is a best-selling author. He tells us how humans fed themselves without fossil fuels for centuries. We hear how you can grow food year-round, including during cold winters and summers made hotter by global warming. Take the green way out with Radio EcoShock. We read relentless headlines about our planet heading out of control. Most of them seem to cruise by without hurting us too deeply. Yeah, half the mammals will be extinct soon. The oceans are dying. Scientists declare Earth a toxic planet. Wait, did somebody say it's going to be too hot to hold outdoor music festivals? That's terrible. I love those. My theory is that we all have triggers and breaking points, especially when it comes to climate change news. A couple of mine arrived this week. Now I'm freaked out again. And that means it's time to call our Radio EcoShock regular correspondent, University of Ottawa scientist Paul Beckwith. Paul teaches climate science at the university. He also teaches it to the world via his many YouTube videos. Paul Beckwith, a warm welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, Alex. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
You bet. Well, you know, no doubt we're all going to need a climate helpline pretty soon. When we get worried, we'll call up and get a climate counselor. How about you, Paul? Do you get freaked out by climate news sometimes?
I do from time to time, but I try to compartmentalize. And although, you know, I do spend a lot of time, you know, reading papers and doing research on all of the changes that are happening. So, you know, I have to make sure I take breaks from it, you know, take a few days off from time to time. No social media, no work, you know, go to a bunch of movies, spend time with the family and kids, you know, go somewhere, do sort of everyday stuff. But yeah, it does get to you. But I think, you know, I've been doing it for long enough now, I've kind of figured out how to sort of keep it not from affecting me personally too deeply or emotionally or anything like that.
Well, there have been recent studies showing more and more people are feeling climate stress, and we don't need science to watch this all happening literally in our backyards. For example, Paul, in this year of 2017, the city of Chicago had no snow in January and February. That's got to be pretty crazy for people who know Great Lakes winters. What was your experience like this winter, Paul?
Well, in Ottawa, yeah, it started off, we had a very warm fall, late fall, and then, you know, then we got quite a bit of snow. You know, it got a bit colder, but then, you know, it goes through these cycles. Then it gets very warm for a while, and then it gets very cold for a while, and then it gets very warm. So it's as the jet streams kind of sweep by. You know, if we're in the trough of the jet stream, then it's warmer than normal, and it could be, you know, 10 degrees Celsius or so. And then as the jet stream passes us and we come into the trough, then we're exposed to the cold Arctic air. And, you know, then it gets quite cold. And, you know, there's been many times this winter when it's been colder in southerly locations like Ottawa as compared to the Arctic, you know, the North Pole. I mean, the Arctic it's unbelievable how warm it's been this year. And the failure of the sea ice to form properly is being watched very closely, you know, and it's in the mainstream news stories and things like that as well.
Yes, indeed. When I look at the climate maps on places like climatereanalyzer.org, I see that there's a big red blotch of much warmer than normal up in the Arctic. And then there's actually a bluer section where I live on the western side of the continent saying it's a little colder than expected. So it almost seems like the heat went up there, and it's very unusual here, as you say, with the jet stream waggling around. Well, okay, here's my first personal trigger. I'm minding my own business, Paul. I'm cruising through gardening videos, and a listener sends me a story by journalist Nafiz Ahmed. He says new science suggests we could experience a burst of warming within the next 5 years. Now, I've had problems getting my usual garden plants to survive the strange hot May and June we had last year. The U.S. National Weather Service says this coming spring will be even hotter. It's going to be a struggle to garden. What do you think, Paul? Could we see an even worse jolt in heating, something maybe we haven't seen before, within the next 5 years?
Yes, I think it's very possible. In fact, you know, it's more than possible. It could even be likely. I mean, there's this index. It falls under the category of teleconnections indices. It's called the Pacific Decadal Oscillation. And basically, when it's in the positive phase, then a lot more heat is going into the atmosphere than in the oceans. And when it's in a negative phase, more heat is being stored in the ocean. So the so-called, you know, hiatus or stall in atmospheric temperature rise around the time of the late 90s with the very powerful El Nino that year, making it an exceptionally hot year that year. But for a while since then, more heat's been going into the ocean than in the atmosphere. So the atmospheric temperatures were rising about 0.1 degree per decade for that period of time, when normally they'd be about 0.15. And what we've seen recently is they increased to 0.2 per decade. And then if you look at just the last several years, we've had a 0.2 degree Celsius increase. So the latest numbers are that we're 1.25 degrees Celsius above the 1880 to 1910 or 1920 average. Now, in order to compare to the pre-industrial, which is 1750, you have to add another 0.3 degrees. So that gives you 1.25 plus 0.3 or 1.55 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial. And that was for the year 2016. So we're already above that 1.5 degree benchmark aspiration from the Paris Climate Agreement. And we're very rapidly approaching that 2 degrees Celsius. So if we continue to get rises of 0.2 degrees globally every few years, if that trend continues, clearly we'll be passing the 2 degree mark within 5 years if that trend was to continue. It looks like part of the reason for the large increase of 0.2 degrees in the last 2 years, you know, a big part of that reason was the very powerful El Nino that we had. And then we went into a La Nina, a bit cooler period, but that fizzled out very quickly. And the word is that we're moving back into another El Nino. So even the El Nino, La Nina cycles, which are, you know, they're from 2 to 7 years, they're a bit irregular. They seem to be leaning towards more powerful El Ninos, which are the warming part of the cycle versus the cooling part of the cycle, the La Nina. So, you know, it's certainly very possible that we can get this warming period. The PDO looks like it's shifting to give more air to the atmosphere. And this paper you're talking about was talking about the number of Hiroshima atomic bombs per second that were heating the ocean.
Wow.
Yes, if we want to use that type of metric, Hiroshima bombs per second, you know, a couple of decades ago, the warming in the oceans was about 2 bombs per second. And then in the last 17 years, it's doubled to about 4 bombs per second. In 2013, it tripled again. So that would be 12 Hiroshima bombs per second warming the oceans. The warming, everything seems to be accelerating rapidly in a highly nonlinear exponential fashion with climate change. Whether you look at temperatures, global temperature warming, which we're talking about, if you look at greenhouse gas levels, the CO2 levels, you know, are regularly going up over 3 parts per million each year. And this is, as the International Energy Agency is saying, that our human anthropogenic emissions are somewhat stabilized, yet they're still, if the atmospheric levels are still going up, then that means that we're losing the sinks of CO2 on the planet, like the Amazon rainforest, boreal forests, et cetera. Phytoplankton are getting weaker, and the sources of CO2 from either permafrost and deep sea sediments, et cetera, are increasing. And that also includes, you know, methane as well. So we're in an emergency situation. Our climate is screaming at us, hey, humans, wake up. We have an emergency situation on our hands, and we need to take proportionate response to try to step back from the precipice. In fact, we've already gone over the precipice, and we're falling rapidly. So we need to be caught, arrested, and pulled back from the precipice. You know, we're certainly in this emergency situation. And this is why, you know, years ago, I was completely against things like, well, things falling under the umbrella of, quote, geoengineering. Carbon dioxide removal, not so much, but solar radiation management, yes. And this is why I've been pushing for this three-legged bar stool approach to dealing with our emergency situation.
Okay, now, so listeners can track this. The paper Stimulating Ahmed's article, advice.com, was published back in 2015 with the title Quantifying the Likelihood of a Continued Hiatus in Global Warming. And I'll put links to that in my blog at ecoshock.org. And I want to say, though, Paul, I began by moaning about personal triggers where the news gets too real. And judging by a recent video of yours, I'm thinking you hit one, too. And I'm talking about stories that billionaires expect to get away from climate collapse by building bunkers in the Southern Hemisphere in places like New Zealand. Maybe we'll all head to New Zealand. What's wrong with that logic?
The problem is that the extreme weather events in the Southern Hemisphere are just as bad, just as extreme as extreme weather events in the Northern Hemisphere, because we have a climate system. So, you know, some of these billionaires, they think, okay, well, we're losing the ice that's causing the disruption in, you know, in the Northern Hemisphere, we're losing the Arctic ice. So move to the Southern Hemisphere where the temperatures, you know, will be moderated somewhat by ocean temperatures and things like that. But the problem is the climate system is connected and they're just as much a part of it as us and will be affected just as much. Because as we lose Arctic sea ice and snow cover, the Arctic gets a lot darker, absorbs a lot more heat. So there's less heat moving from the equator to the Arctic. So the jet streams slow down and become wavier and we get all these extreme weather events in the Northern Hemisphere. But because there's more heat at the equator, a lot of that heat goes into more evaporation of the water. So there's more clouds and more water vapor and more storms in the equator. But the heat also rises. And if you reach that wet bulb temperature of 35 degrees, then parts of the land surface become uninhabitable to humans. But that heat has to also go to the Southern Hemisphere, which it does. And if the equator's hotter, more heat's going to the Southern Hemisphere. It gets down to Australia, New Zealand region, causes very high temperatures there, but it also changes the wind patterns around Antarctica. It changes the sea ice formation around Antarctica, and the warm water, ocean water, is undercutting in Antarctica and melting a lot of ice there. So the problem is as the jet streams around Antarctica become much wavier, as they slow down with the warming of Antarctica, then they will actually reach up to areas like New Zealand and Australia. So there will be a lot more climate variability, weather variability, certainly in New Zealand and Australia as Antarctica warms and loses ice, both on land ice shelves, and sea ice. And we've seen record lows of sea ice in Antarctica this year. I mean, a couple of years ago, we had record highs in the sea ice around Antarctica. So we're getting these large gyrations in Antarctica, which we've been seeing in the Arctic. So we have a connected climate system that these people would be much better off hiring top PR firms, influencing politicians and government to declare a climate change emergency and get strong action. We're all in this boat together. You know, when the tide comes in, all boats rise. When the tide goes out, all boats fall. So they're just in bigger boats than the rest of us.
They do have some big boats. Some of them have 150-foot, 300-foot yachts, but there is not going to be any safe place to hide. We know that. Now, you raised one of the next topics I wanted to talk to you about, which is survivability at the tropics. I've had scientists on the show saying the tropics won't warm that much. The theory was that Earth had a sort of general thermostat, and the tropics are about as warm as they can get. But now Dr. Matthew Huber and his Climate Dynamics Prediction Laboratory have published a new paper saying there is no global thermostat. The paper, you may not have seen it, just came out March 3rd, 2017 in Science Advances. It says, evidence disproving tropical thermostat theory, global warming can breach limits for life. Now, that's not what you want to hear, can breach limits for life. So they looked at the last great warming event, the Paleo-Eocene Thermal Maximum, the PETM, around 56 million years ago. And quoting from the abstract, it says, global ocean temperatures rapidly warmed by about 5 degrees C. That sounds pretty drastic, and I assume that can't happen anytime soon, but maybe the tropics will warm right out of control.
As you get warming of the surface of the ocean, of course, that water is much lighter. So it becomes very, very highly stratified on the ocean. So you get less mixing. So when we talk about warming of 5 degrees C, I mean, it's quite easy to see that the sea surface temperature can warm significantly. And the more it warms, the lighter it is and the more stratified it is. So this becomes not just an issue of the heat going into the ocean, but it's an issue with the vertical movement of water, so upwelling and downwelling in the ocean, which also depends on water currents and the geometry of coastlines and all these different factors. It also depends, of course, on the salinity of the water. So as we get more meltwater from Greenland, say, from Antarctica, and as that water is heated on the surface, then if there's less mixing, then it takes longer for that water, the fresh water, to be completely mixed to reach that sort of average ocean salinity of 35 parts per thousand or 3.5% of salt content. So there's a lot of different factors into play, but the heat capacity of water is enormous compared to that of air. So this is a concern. I mean, if all that heat that's been going into the oceans over decades, if more of that heat is released to the atmosphere, then that will cause a large jump in temperature. I mean, generally, when we talk about global average temperatures and stuff, we're talking about air temperatures because that's where we experience, right? But we're getting more and more and better data from ocean temperatures through the water column. And we've got these Argo floats and we've got various sensors. So we're getting more data on those sort of profiles, and we're seeing massive shifts in the ocean. And not only that, when there's less mixing, the pH of the ocean can drop significantly on the surface and not be mixed throughout the water column. So ocean acidification is a huge issue, and it's dropping to levels. We've already had declines of about 30% in the last few decades of the pH. So that's an increase in acidity in the ocean. So we're about 8.05, down from 8.2 about three decades ago or so. And when we hit 7.9, 7.8, then we take a big hit on the marine food chain. We're already seeing issues in certain locations where the Arctic Ocean, for example, is becoming much more acidic. And there was a recent paper out about that as well. So like all the physical factors from the planet are screaming at us that we have a climate change emergency. And of course, this leads some people to say, throw up their hands and say, look, there's nothing we can do. I mean, I call it the D&D crowd. We have the deniers. Right. And then deniers, when they say, OK, there's stuff going on, but then we can't do anything about it. And then we have the doomer crowd right on the other end of the spectrum saying, you know, we can't do anything about it, you know, and giving ridiculously short timelines for utter catastrophe and extinction and stuff like that. So I did a number of videos to try to point out that, you know, hey, it's not all black and white. There's gray areas in between. Right. The Earth is large. That you don't have a complete collapse simultaneously around the planet. You have different pressures occurring to different countries and different regions of the planet at different rates, depending on their latitude, depending on the resilience of the countries, depending on their level of, you know, what percentage of their income is spent on food, for example. If it's half and food prices double, then your country's finished, right? Right. So, you know, and it ties into migration issues and things. It also ties into countries becoming, you know, the politics going to becoming more protectionist, you know, anti-immigrant sort of thing. I mean, we're seeing it all. It all fits into this big picture. You know, the root cause is this abrupt climate change that we're experiencing.
Yes, this is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex, talking with our regular correspondent, Paul Beckwith. He teaches climate science at the University of Ottawa in Canada. His website is paulbeckwith.net. Well, Paul, I'm lining up another guest that may be closer to your own interests. He's in the Middle East, in Oman, to be exact. And so the connections are a bit dicey. But anyway, their team is exploring whether rocks cast up from the Earth's mantle might be able to absorb a significant portion of our emissions. And apparently the mantle rocks have been out of touch with our atmosphere for so long, these rocks are ready to absorb really big amounts of carbon. Have you heard about that?
I haven't heard about that specific study, but rocks are during periods in the Earth's past history when there's a lot of rocks exposed, then those rocks are weathered and the weathering process absorbs CO2, reduces the CO2 levels in the atmosphere. But generally, this process is a very long time scale process. So can we increase the rate of reaction? So it's a chemical reaction. So higher temperatures, reaction rates increase. As you get larger surface area, the chemical reaction increases. So one of the ideas, for example, with olivine is a mineral in rocks, which absorbs lots of CO2. So if you grind it up into a very fine powder, that greatly increases the surface area. And if you put this crushed powder on surfaces, on pathways, you know, on roofs, if you put it in the water, then it absorbs tremendous amounts of CO2. But you, of course, have to look at the whole energy budget of this because it takes a lot of energy to grind up rocks. Of course, there was the experiment in Iceland where you inject CO2 deep under the ground, and they found that it would turn into rock very quickly. They thought it would take decades to even centuries, and after a few years, a significant amount of the CO2 seemed to be trapped into rocks that were formed down underneath the ground in these deep mines. So this, the idea of bringing up rock from deep in the earth is the same sort of idea. It's how do we accelerate the weathering process? And there's a lot of research going into that. This fits under the umbrella of CDR, or carbon dioxide removal. I mean, personally, I think that the best options for carbon dioxide removal are to try to get some balance in the biosphere, because we have actually reduced the biomass on the planet significantly in the last 100, 200 years. And we've obviously gone overboard on animals, and we've degraded plants significantly. So if we could restore some of that balance, you know, for example, we've lost 90% of the large fish in the oceans. If we had that 90% back, that's an enormous amount of carbon that wouldn't be in the atmosphere, wouldn't be in the oceans, making them acidified. If we stimulated phytoplankton growth in massive amounts and then, you know, restored the web, the trophic webs in the ocean, that would be a way to have a lot of carbon out of the atmosphere ocean system. So these are things that we can do. I mean, we can't keep cutting down forests and replacing them with agriculture and things like that. You know, we have to look at these issues. There's no one solution to this, but these things all fall under the umbrella of carbon dioxide removal. It's sort of letting nature do what it normally does and actually enhancing the process and trying to accelerate it, because we are in an emergency situation.
What have you heard lately about the methane situation?
Yeah, methane, the levels are definitely going up in the Arctic regions, especially in regions where there used to be sea ice coverage at least part of the year, and now it's open year-round. I did a series of videos on looking at methods that naturally removed methane. So if methane was coming up from the seafloor, for example, how much methane would be broken down by bacteria, et cetera, microorganisms in the mud, in the sediments itself? How much would go into the water column as bubbles? How much would be broken down in the water column by aerobic respiration in the presence of oxygen? And how much would get into the atmosphere, et cetera? So I did a series of videos on this. So I think the point is, if there's very large episodic bursts of methane into the water column, then most of that methane makes it into the atmosphere. If the methane is coming out over vast areas, but, you know, in smaller amounts, sort of trickling out, then there will be a lot less of that methane getting up into the atmosphere in that scenario, because a lot of it will be broken down in the sediment and in the water columns. So it was looking at methane class rates in particular. It wasn't considering the methane on, of course, we know that the methane coming up from the permafrost, you know, is a huge threat. We see lots of slump and these methane holes, sort of the methane craters. You know, we see coastal erosion with the release of methane. We see all of these things happening. So I know there are some very interesting ideas looking at how can we break down methane better once it gets up into the atmosphere. I mean, naturally, the sun shortwave radiation has enough energy to break water molecules apart. It breaks the hydrogen off, so you have the OH minus, and that's sort of the cleanser in the atmosphere, if you like. It reacts with methane, producing CO2 and water. I mean, the CO2 is not good, but the methane's at, you know, more of a part per billion level than a part per million level. So the CO2 produced when the OH minus hydroxide breaks apart the methane molecule it's not the biggest concern because it's at a lot lower level. And of course, the global warming potential of methane is enormous compared to that of CO2. You know, even on a 100-year average time scale, it's 34 times, going to 86 times over 20 years, and probably 150 to 200 times more powerful than the CO2 molecule on a few year time scale, which is the time scale that we should really be concerned about.
All right. Well, Paul, we're starting to run out of time for what I have this week. I've got two quick questions for you. And the first one is that what if the developing ecological reality becomes so terrible, so unreal, that even the scientists who have the facts start to look like end-of-the-world freaks? Maybe my listeners will get tired of it and drift away. Maybe you'll be banned from teaching new climate science at university. Are we already getting there?
I don't think we're there yet. You know, it's possible. I mean, it's a concern, you know, that we go there. But, I mean, the scientific community is generally pretty reserved and pretty quiet. And the U.S. political situation, there's a march of scientists coming up, you know, in sort of the end of April in the U.S., and I think it's going to happen also in Canada. I mean, in Canada, this is not new to us. We had Harper for 8 years. We had muzzling of scientists. We had a lot of problems, and scientists marched in Ottawa. There was 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 scientists that marched a few years ago. And, you know, most people in the U.S. aren't even aware that happened in Canada. You know, now we're seeing the equivalent thing happening in the U.S. So, you know, I think scientists are starting to realize that they can't just continue to do their business as usual, you know, be quiet and in the labs and just publish papers. I mean, more and more of them are coming out to speak to the media. You know, this is a problem. We don't have much choice. I mean, we have to try to do what we can. The scope of the problem is enormous, but we have to take steps and see what we can do to arrest and slow down the problem. So there's obviously a lot of different stages of emotions that come into play. We have to recognize that and think of strategies to deal with. Think of deniers and some of the strategies that they might use. I mean, they say, first of all, they say climate change isn't happening. And then if they agree it's happening, they say, well, there's nothing we can do about it anyway. And then there's the people that think we're too far down the path of abrupt climate change and we can't do anything about it anyway. So the net result is you have the D&D crowd are saying we can't do anything about it. And I just can't accept that. We haven't even tried to do anything on a really serious basis about this. Sure, renewable energies are growing in leaps and bounds. This is one aspect, but this is not sufficient. You know, we need to take CO2 out of the atmosphere. We need to look at deploy ways to cool the Arctic so we don't get this complete loss of Greenland ice and methane coming up and all the rest of it. So we're not defenseless. We can't just roll over. So, you know, I'm very hopeful that once we actually decide that, hey, you know, we have a real huge problem here, once we collectively as a society decide this, then we do everything we can to back away from the precipice. And that hasn't happened. So how can we possibly think about, you know, throw up our hands and say we can't do anything when this hasn't even been, we haven't even reached the stage yet. And right. So it doesn't make any sense to me. But, you know, it's understandable that there's people that go from, you know, that experience this range of emotions, I guess.
Yeah, well, I'm with you, Paul. I'm freaked out, but I'm not giving up, and I'm going to keep doing this program until people wake up to some degree or start to do something, and I think we will eventually. We've been talking with climate scientist Paul Beckwith. He's a generalist, really. He studies the big picture. He's an educator by day at the University of Ottawa, and he's a public educator all the time, providing science for the masses on YouTube. You can find all this at paulbeckwith.net. I'll put links to the science we talked about in my show blog at ecoshock.org. And stay tuned for some in-depth interviews with some of those scientists. Paul Beckwith, I always appreciate your visits. Thank you for spending your valuable time with us.
Well, thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Thomas Crowther, I know it's exciting to discover results in science, but this is really bad news heaped on already bad news. Does it bother you?
I have to admit, sometimes it does. I really, you know, of course I want to understand the world, and if that understanding of the world can bring some sad news, then certainly it's not always enjoyable. And it seems very strange when you sort of celebrate a big discovery, but that discovery is about something so catastrophic for potentially for humanity. You know, it's a really serious impact. But what I would stress is that I do certainly see the positive side of this. I think if we're going to fight against something as considerable as climate change, the first thing we need to do is understand how considerable it's going to be. And once we get a handle on future climate conditions, and once we understand what the climate's going to do, it's only then that we can really set meaningful targets to fight against it. So I like to believe that this is certainly contributing to our fight against climate change.
What is your aim in philosophy? To show the fly the way out of the fly bottle. Are you a bad philosopher, then, if what you write is hard to understand? If you were better, you would make what is difficult easy to understand. But who says that's possible?
Would you like to rip fresh greens from your own backyard, even in winter? It sounds impossible until you get a tour of Caleb Warnock's winter garden. I just got his book about it. I'm not talking about greens in Florida or even in Vancouver. Caleb Warnock lives near Salt Lake City, Utah, with lots of altitude and lots of snow. He's the author of many popular books on self-sufficiency, healthy foods, and tips from the pioneers. Caleb Warnock, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
We can buy all sorts of greens and tropical fruits even, trucked in or flown across the ocean. Why should we go to a lot of work to grow our own food?
Well, I think if people are either sort of interested in this or they're not, they've already discovered that if you want to take control of your health and your budget, then you have to do some things on your own. You can't just rely on everyone else to do things for you. And I think the biggest reason, however, is flavor. Nothing that you can buy tastes like what you can grow.
And I think that flavor is telling us something, Caleb. I think that the vitamins and all the things that have been lost in shipping. And in fact, they just grow foods that will ship well and don't taste good. So there's a lot to be said for growing your own food.
Well, worse than that, they irradiate it. And, you know, before it comes to the grocery store, they put all kinds of pesticides and insecticides.
Yep.
You know, herbicides. And they do all kinds of crazy things that, you know, you would never do when you're growing it in your own backyard. So it's better all the way around.
What drove you personally to rediscover lost skills and aim for better self-sufficient foods?
I was really lucky to have grown up in the last kitchens and gardens of the people who were really connected to the earth. I knew my great-grandparents on both sides of my family. I grew up with my great-grandparents on both sides of my family. This is how they lived every day. And, you know, as after I lost my great-grandparents, then I just wanted to keep doing what they were doing. I mean, I had wonderful memories of being in their gardens and eating in their kitchens. And the longer I have lived, the more I have discovered that there's just no equivalent to making it yourself, growing it yourself, or cooking it yourself.
One of your books is titled The Forgotten Skills of Self-Sufficiency Used by the Mormon Pioneers. Caleb, has a Mormon background helped you recover these lost skills?
Well, you know, you're either born with your background or you're not, and that book is not about religion, but these are the people that, you know, they came here into the middle of this crazy place where no one thought anything would ever grow, and they made it work. And those tips, those skills, those things that they knew how to do are almost gone today, and that's why so many people, I think, have responded to my books and my videos and my classes. And because we live in a world today where everybody has a skill or a thought or an idea in the internet, but a lot of that is not based in actual knowledge. Like, people are offering opinions about things that they've never done, never tried, when they offer photos from the first day of something instead of the fifth year of something. And so I think that's why people have responded, because this is the way our family lives every day. This is the way we have lived for years. And people, I know we've had thousands of people come here to our gardens and tour them. And when they see this working firsthand, they feel inspired. They feel like, oh my goodness, look how it's being done here at my house as compared to what we get out of the grocery store or, you know, whatever the skill is. And this can be done. And this is the way it was done for thousands of years before the invention of the modern grocery store.
Well, this is one of the things I admire about your YouTube videos and now your book, and that is that when you make a mistake, you don't hide it. There's the photo of the dead plant, and you tell us what you did wrong and what you could do better next time. Do you have a couple of examples of epic failures that we can avoid?
I don't believe there is failure. I believe that there's honesty. I think what is missing today from the world, in great part, is people are very... If they think they have created something successful, they want to talk all about it, but they don't often want to talk about what it took to get from zero to success. And that's something that our ancestors would never have... I mean, they didn't consider failure to be a bad thing. They considered it to be an education, and I consider it to be an education. And I think people do a real disservice to people, especially in the homesteading community and the self-sufficiency community, when they want to go out and say, oh, look what I've done, and they don't want to tell people all the steps and all of the work that it took to get there. So to me, there's no failure about it. It's just like, for example, right now, one of the things that people are really responding to are my solar thermal and geothermal greenhouses. I have spent years now designing and redesigning and rebuilding, and now people come to my property in the middle of the winter, and I have four greenhouses that don't use any electricity or artificial heat. They're just completely heated by nature, and they walk in and they go, oh my gosh, who taught you how to do this? And I say, well, I taught me how to do this over the last 15 years. I taught me how to do this. I've spent lots of time and lots of money, and I don't consider any of my early attempts to be a failure. I consider it to be an education and necessary steps.
Well, this is one of the reasons I wanted your book, Winter Gardening, because I'm just about to build a geothermal greenhouse this coming spring, and I've been looking at all sorts of videos, of course, on YouTube. My plan is to lay about 300 feet of drainage pipe about 5 feet down with some gravel around it. And then I will probably use electricity and a fan to blow that earth cool when I need it in the summertime and hot, you know, when I need it in the wintertime. What did you do? What has been your most successful geothermal setup, let's say that?
Well, I hope I can be honest with you. What you have just described is not a good way to go about doing it.
Okay.
I hope that's not too blunt and too honest. And what you have described is exactly what people come up with when they do searching on the internet. And a lot of that information is from people who have not done it, have not tried it, and that method is extremely expensive. It'll never pay off in the end, and it doesn't, you know, we have to work hand in hand with Mother Nature. I think that's something that people have kind of lost sight of a little bit today, is that when you work hand in hand with Mother Nature, she will work with you. And we, for some reason as a society, we have started to, I don't know exactly where this comes from, but we want to fight Mother Nature every step of the way. And what you're describing is kind of a method of trying to, you know, fight a war against Mother Nature. And you know, I've had a lot of people come to my classes and read my books. And my greenhouse classes are probably some of my most popular, most attended classes. I've had people fly in from Alaska to take my greenhouse classes because they build what you're describing and it does not give them the results that they want. And then they come to me and they say, okay, now how do I fix this? How do I make this actually work? That happened even yesterday. Somebody was putting a picture up on a Facebook homesteading group that I belong to saying, this is the existing greenhouse. It didn't work. It was a total failure over the winter. Now what do I do? It's a lot better to do it right the first time instead of spending a lot of time and money to discover that you're going to have to retrofit things.
Well, what should I be doing then?
Well, I mean, that's not a question that I can answer in 60 seconds, but, you know, I think what's important for people to know is that all of the commercial greenhouses that you see are not designed for winter growing because they do not have thermal mass. You can have a geothermal greenhouse or you can have a solar thermal greenhouse. I'm at 5,000 feet. My coldest temperature this winter was 19 degrees below zero. I have growing things in my unheated. I mean, the greenhouses are heated by the heat of the earth, and they have to be designed in a way where they can capture the heat during the day and release that heat during the night and rely on the heat of the earth during the night to keep the greenhouse from freezing. And that has taken a long journey for me to figure out how that can be done. But it is, once you figure out how to do it, it works gorgeously. And people, I have online classes about this. I have video tours about this. I think this is so important because people today have forgotten that before World War I, everyone grew food through the winter. Today we kind of think, oh my goodness, that's kind of like a parlor trick to grow food through the winter. We forget that if people didn't know how to grow food through the winter, we wouldn't be here today because they didn't have any choice or any option in the matter. You know, they perfected that skill and they perfected that art a long time ago, a long, long time ago. So it's not difficult and it's not hard. You just have to pay attention to the natural signs and be able to work together with Mother Nature.
Okay, now part of the challenge for folks with a greenhouse or with cold frames is to remember that in the northern hemisphere, I'd say August is the second planting season. And plants can often survive in the cold, but they don't grow a lot unless they get a good start. But Caleb, how do we get cold weather plants going when it's really hot out in the summer?
Well, the only thing that you need to start in the summer are things, and when we're talking at the very end of the summer, like the last week of July is when you want to start your root vegetables. If you're going to have root vegetables that you want to be able to harvest before December 31st, they need to be planted in the very last weeks of July and the first weeks of August. Everything else can be planted later. And it's just a matter at that point. They germinate pretty easily because the soil is pretty warm. At that point, it's just a matter of making sure that they don't dry out during the germination period.
The other tricky part about winter gardening, I guess, is to get actual growth. I've had experts tell me their winter greenhouse is like a vegetable storage place, and what you pick is always fresh. But have you found greens that can be cut and regrow again, even in cold and dim winter light conditions?
Well, that's all we do. I mean, I don't know if you know this, but after my first book became a national bestseller, I had a lot of the rarest seeds in the world because I had spent years reading books that were 300 and 400 years old and then having help with seed banks to track down the last of these seeds that have been going extinct. And today, because of all of that, because my book became a national bestseller, I own a seed company. And no one in the world has tested, no one has, I mean, I have so many varieties of the winter growing vegetables that don't exist anywhere else, that you can't buy anywhere else, because this is not a segment of gardening that anybody else has been focusing on. And so when you have the correct seeds and the correct plants, you have to remember that our ancestors were not growing the same things in the winter that they were growing in the regular growing season. So when you have the correct plants and the correct seeds, then you have success in the winter garden. And so, yes, every green thing that we grow is cut and come again. And all of the bulb varieties, like, for example, the best winter-growing turnip is something called the Vertumaro turnip, which I'm the last grower of in the United States. And these are things that were widely, widely available 200 years ago, even 150 years ago, but today they're almost extinct. And so you have to have the right things if you want to grow stuff during the winter. It's not, my greenhouses are not a food storage. You know, and if you've seen my video tours, you know that that's not what's going on in my greenhouses, not in my cold frames, not in my all-natural hotbeds. We grow 365 days a year. I start seeds directly in the ground in every month of the year, just like the people who came before us used to do.
Do you want to give us a web address where people can get these seeds?
It's seedrenaissance.com.
Okay. Now, I just want to say I spend most of my time interviewing climate scientists from all over the world. That's what I do on Radio EcoShock. And they're warning loudly that we may see even more heat waves than we've had. And you've worked on how to garden when it's too cold, but what about when it's too hot?
Yeah, too high. Well, last year, for the first time in history, I had in my garden 100-degree temperatures in the first week of June. And the National Weather Service in the United States about a week ago predicted that we're going to repeat that again this summer. Their prediction is that we're going to have the hottest, earliest spring on record. And if you don't know how to garden correctly, that can wreak havoc on your garden. When you're dealing with heat like that, you have to have short day count vegetables. And short day count vegetables are vegetables that go from seed to harvestability in a very short amount of time. Most of what is sold in the United States today is medium to long day count vegetables, but those don't do well in this kind of heat situation. And a lot of people struggled, at least in the western United States last year, a lot of people struggled because we had these temperatures that we had 100-degree temperatures in every week of June, and that's not typical or normal. And this year we may hit triple digits at the end of May is what they're predicting. So we have to change. We have to be able to adapt. One of the things that people have been responding to is that I've been teaching people how to plant food forests. Food forests are perennial vegetables, trees, bushes that you can put out, and then they follow Mother Nature's cycle and plant themselves from year to year. I have a garden that is 60% self-seeding and perennial in the summer and 80% in the winter, so that I don't have to go out and plant a lot of stuff every year. It just, this is the way that, you know, people gardened, you know, for most of history, is they weren't out there planting rows of things every spring, despite what the movies may show you. That's not how it was happening. They relied on perennial and self-seeding vegetables to feed themselves, and that's the way that successful gardeners will continue to go forward, because those vegetables plant themselves and reseed themselves at the moment they need to, working on Mother Nature's schedule without humans trying to guess when the best time is to do that.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest from Utah is Caleb Warnock. Now, you could call it permaculture, what you've just talked about, I think, or you could call it old school gardening, but can you tell us, what is the prepping or self-sufficiency scene like in Utah?
Well, I may not be a good person to ask about that, because I tell everyone who will listen that we should stop being prepared and start being self-reliant. One of the things that really concerns me is that people think that preparedness means putting thousands of dollars worth of freeze-dried garbage into some dusty storage bin, and then they don't feel that they need to learn to grow something on their own. And I'm sort of famous for telling people that when the zombie apocalypse happens, if I have to live on freeze-dried garbage, I'm going to run out and ask the zombies to eat me first, because that's not something I'm willing to do. I think that we need to have preparedness in the form of self-reliance today. A lot of people think that they can just spend money and put something away, but that is not self-reliance. And I'm also kind of famous for telling people that I don't care about you, but I do care about your children and your grandchildren. I think that we are doing a huge disservice by not. We teach our children and our grandchildren the fine art of living off of a credit card and watching the video games and watching television, and we don't get them out into the garden. They can't tell a weed from a vegetable. They don't know. If worse came to worse, they wouldn't know how to grow anything in the most ideal growing conditions, let alone the more difficult growing conditions, let alone in the winter or anything like that. And that's not their fault. That's our fault for not teaching them those skills. And I really feel strongly, and I'm very passionate about the fact that our kids and our grandkids are going to need some self-reliance skills, and that we are doing them a disservice when we don't take the time to teach them those things. So stop preparing, stop buying garbage to put away, get out into the garden and plant something, even if it's just a raspberry bush. I like to tell people, just even if it's if you do nothing else, children will respond to raspberries and strawberries, and they will grow up remembering that at least there was something edible within their space.
Do we need a few acres and a homestead to grow food, or can our listeners really do very much in their backyards or, say, in a community garden?
What a waste of space it would be to have. I have lots of friends who have lots of acres. I had someone who was talking to me yesterday who has 150 acres, and they are completely overwhelmed and lost and have no idea what to do. My wife and I live on an acre and a third, and we use about a third of that as far as growing goes. Again, this goes back to the way this has been done historically. Nobody historically was feeding their family on these huge tracts of land, because every square foot of land has to be correctly managed. So they knew how to grow a lot of food in a small space. I was accused once, after someone had come to tour one of my greenhouses in the winter, I was accused of they went on social media and openly accused me and my family of secretly being on food stamps and on welfare, because they said there's no way that Caleb could be feeding himself and his family on this small, in this small of a greenhouse through the winter. And that just, we still laugh about that at my house, because that just shows what an absolute lack of knowledge they have. Because people assume that you grow a head of lettuce and then you rip the whole head of lettuce out of the ground, and so they see that there's 20 heads of lettuce in my greenhouse in December, and they think I have 20 heads of lettuce, when in fact you cut the head of lettuce and it grows right back within 3 weeks. So it's a rotation. That's the way people have fed themselves. We know how, and I've actually written a whole book called Tiny Garden, Huge Harvest, because doing it on a smaller scale is the way to be successful. Getting 150 acres is not the way to be successful. Nobody can manage 150 acres without a tractor and gasoline and all kinds of things that have not been used throughout the history of the world.
You've also written a book called Stress-Free Vegetable Gardening. Can you share a couple of tips to avoid working too hard for those veggies?
Yeah, so I'll give you a tip. I think one of the most important things is that people should know is, as soon as the ground thaws out, there's a whole host of things, because right now, where I live, the ground is beginning to thaw out. So I have an email newsletter, and I just sent out my newsletter telling everybody, as soon as the ground thaws out, here's an entire list, vegetable by vegetable, of things that we should be planting now, especially this year when we're going to have an early spring. For example, if you want to do rutabagas, they have to be planted within the next week, or they will not produce a bulb successfully this year if they're not planted within the next week. Carrots and parsnips need to be planted immediately, because carrots and parsnips both have a longer germination time, and they need some colder temperatures, and they need continual moisture. And so now is the time to plant, you know, probably 40 to 50 things that I listed in my email, so that you don't have to water them. All you have to do is either throw the seed out or lightly rake it in and let Mother Nature take care of it, because there will still be rains. The soil is moist right now, and these are vegetables that need cooler soil temperatures in order to successfully germinate and to start make something edible before the tremendous heat comes, and it is going to come.
And I'd like listeners to know about the range of books that you've written. Do you want to tell us a few titles, including a couple on the specialty foods that you have explored?
Specialty foods, that's a funny term. I think you're probably referring to I have a book called The Art of Baking with Natural Yeast. We only use natural yeast. Most people don't know that all the yeast that you buy today in the grocery store has been genetically modified and is patented, and you don't have to take my word for that. You can go look up all of the patents for it. That natural yeast has not been sold in the grocery store for decades, and natural yeast, because it was created through a process of gene mutation called mutagenesis, no longer amidates the gluten that is naturally found in wheat and is making everybody sick. So natural yeast will make regular wheat flour safe for people to eat without gluten intolerance or celiac disease. I have a couple of books on herbal medicine. We have all kinds of books on gardening and mindful meals. And I don't know, I've written, right now there are 19 books that are available. There are more that are coming out. I have a book that I'm very proud of on stevia. Stevia is an herb, a green herb that has very sugary leaves, that is the answer to a lot of problems that people are having today health-wise. I'm a huge believer in stevia. I've been growing stevia for years, and a lot of people have no idea what stevia is or how to use it, and so I wrote a whole book on that. It's the first book of its kind that's ever been published, and I continue today to go out and, you know, even last night I was researching chia seeds, and there's actually a version of the chia seed that grows wild where I live, and, you know, these things are very difficult to come by, but I'm managing to get my hands on some, and I just continue to explore. I've been teaching homesteading classes for people, and you know, I'm interested in anything that we can do to make our lives easier and to make ourselves more self-reliant. But again, my mantra is to make sure that our children and our grandchildren are going to be prepared to live the life. A lot of people say to themselves that they have passed on the most important values of their ancestors to their children. But if you stop and think about that, that is not true. And I'm very concerned about that.
Okay, so how do we connect with you, Caleb? Do you have a blog? Do you have a Facebook page going? How do we get this newsletter? Tell us about that.
Yeah, I'm on Facebook. You can find me on Facebook. Just type Caleb Warnock into Facebook, and I will be there. And my website is seedrenaissance.com. You can sign up for my newsletter at seedrenaissance.com. And there's usually free offers in most of my books that, you know, I send free seeds and yeast and all kinds of things to tens of thousands of people. So it's not too hard to find me.
Great. Well, I just got one of them from Utah. We've been talking with the best-selling author, Caleb Warnock. I've been lurking around his YouTube videos and blog, and I just ordered his book on backyard winter gardening. And you can find links for all of this in my weekly Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.org. Caleb, thank you so much for sharing with us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
I'm going to wrap up with something completely different. This song, Blindsided by Taylor Barton, sounds Christian, but it also has a climate side as she sings, Someone Torched the Kingdom. Thank you for listening. Let's meet again next week.
Exploded all over. nothing we gained, nothing we lost, added to the Holy Cross.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
Regardless of the threats and smearings and attacks and bullying, we will keep fighting for what's right. We will win at the end. And the Palestine cause is a just and a fair issue, as we all believe. And supporting justice in Palestine is not terrorism and it's not anti-Semitism. It's, by contrast, a right and it's a duty.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast. In Oakland, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. A student at Exeter University in the UK has been elected to lead the Students Guild as a trustee, and because of her Palestine activism, she has been subjected to a barrage of threats, intimidation, and harassment, as well as a coordinated smear campaign by Israel-aligned groups in the UK. Malika Muhammad, an occasional contributor to the Electronic Intifada, is from the Gaza Strip and for the past several years as a law student and now as a graduate student has been organizing direct actions in support of Palestinian rights. The attacks Malika has faced have been similar to those faced by Malia Bouatia, the current president of the National Union of Students. Pro-Israel propagandists, including a senior officer in the National Union of Students, planned to oust Bouatia, which was revealed in undercover footage in a recent Al Jazeera documentary on Britain's pro-Israel lobby. This week, the Exeter Students Guild remarked that it has completed a thorough investigation into complaints against Malika Muhammad and determined that she was found to have, quote, not brought the charity into disrepute. Joining us from Exeter is Malika. Malika, thank you so much for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you, Noura, for having me.
So let's begin by having you lay out what happened. Tell us about your election to the Exeter Students Guild and these attacks against you, when they began.
Good. So the attacks on me started around a month ago. I was coming back from Ireland after a tour talk there in some universities. And I was checking my Twitter account and I found that basically that article from a charity here called Campaign Against Antisemitism. The article is basically using all words bad that you can imagine, threatening, smearing, attacking, and everything else. And this basically is not the first time Israeli aligned groups in the UK attacked Muslim women of color in position of power. As you've mentioned in your introduction, Malia Bouatia has been through a similar smearing campaign as soon as she decided to run for the National Union of Students election last year. And now she's rerunning, and again, another smearing campaign is being launched against her. She was called last year anti-Semite terrorist sympathizer. And today, and as I have been also running for the Students Guild Vice President position, sort of like a similar campaign has been launched to smear me again, using almost the same label that Malia was falsely accused of. It's a bit like funny where they come from, these like labels and these words. I have no idea how they come to that conclusion. And unfortunately, the Israeli lobby does not stop here. They called the University of Exeter to expel me. They also emailed the university and the guild to investigate what they call my anti-Semitic behavior. They also called the guild to sack me from the three positions of power that I was elected to. And as you've mentioned in your introduction, I'm glad to say that following the trustee board has met last week and they discussed the accusation and they concluded that none of my words or action has brought the charity into disrepute. The decision was taken in an unbiased and fair way. So they've consulted the legal advisor of the union and the external trustee board members and the officers of the students' unions in Exeter. And it's interesting that all this happened because of one complaint by a student in the university and tens, if not hundreds, of emails and messages that the university and the Exeter Guild of Students has got. Lots of external pressure, but yes, the first half is cleared, and I'm currently seeking some legal advice beyond the university for hopefully further action against all the attack in media.
That's the voice of Malika Muhammad speaking to us from the University of Exeter in the UK. Malika, can you describe the current atmosphere maybe more broadly for Palestine activists at Exeter and across UK campuses in general? It's Israeli Apartheid Week, for example, and events were held at 30 universities already across the UK, despite what the Electronic Intifada's contributor Michael Diaz called a massive government-backed campaign of repression. The UK Universities Minister Joe Johnson, for example, wrote a letter titled Tackling Anti-Semitism on Campus, which, just like U.S. politicians here, he attempts to tie Palestine rights activism with anti-Semitism in order to discredit and smear campaigners. Talk about the atmosphere for Palestine rights campaigners on UK campuses.
Yeah, sure. I think this year has been very critical. I've been in the UK for some 4 years. I've never seen something as critical as it has been this year. The right of free speech in campus has been threatened. So many of my friends who are pro-Palestine supporters has been labeled as anti-Semites. Many of them has been labeled as terrorists for no reason again. And in Exeter, for instance, one of our events has been cancelled by the university. One of the University of Lancashire, almost all the events that they have for Israeli Apartheid Week has been also cancelled. But my message, and I'm sure Palestine supporters in the UK have sort of like share this message as well. These attacks on free speech in our campus is a sign that we are making a change. We are positive and impactful in what we're doing. And this attack will not and will never deter us from continuing to fight against all forms of injustice and racism. By contrast, I believe that speaking to friends and colleagues here in Exeter and in Friends of Palestine Society that we have, which was the society that organized the Israeli Apartheid Week here in Exeter, they mentioned that this year Israeli Apartheid Week has been actually one of the best ever that they have for the past maybe like 10 years. They have made like a great impact, like the sort of activities that they had, and students have joined them in hundreds for events. And I was not here for like most of the Israeli Apartheid Week this year. I was in Turkey giving a speech in one of the conferences there. But I'm sure, like from seeing like lots of students here, they said that the Israeli Apartheid Week has been making a lot of impact, a huge one. And regardless of the threats and smearings and attacks and bullying, we will keep fighting for what's right. We will win at the end. And the Palestine cause is a just and a fair issue, as we all believe. And supporting justice in Palestine is not terrorism and it's not anti-Semitism. It's, by contrast, a right, and it's a duty, and we will keep fighting for what's right and what is like our duty to do, and we'll keep just doing what we're doing because we think and we believe that we will make a change one day.
And of course, for our listeners who don't know, Israeli Apartheid Week is an international series of events that seeks to raise awareness of Israel's settler colonial project and apartheid system over the Palestinian people and to build support for the growing BDS, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement. That's from the Israeli Apartheid Week website at apartheidweek.org. Malika, let's talk a little bit about some of the other kinds of activism that you've been involved in recently. You helped organize a march in response to the white supremacist messages found at your university and also against the U.S. Muslim ban. Can you talk a little bit about that kind of activism and how that fits into your Palestine-centered activism on campus?
Sure. As I mentioned before, that speaking up for justice in Palestine or being a Palestine supporter, being a Palestine activist, means that you're also standing against all forms of racism, from Islamophobia to anti-Semitism. And this is what we have been trying to do as Palestine activists here in the UK. So in Exeter, for instance, in the past 2 months, there were two events that took place against racism and fascism. I was proud to co-organize both of them. And one was against the Trump decision to ban people from 7 majority Muslim countries. And it was, according to a journalist from RTV, that was the largest protest in Exeter in the past 20 years. And the other was following a swastika and rights for white that were graffitied in Exeter. And we marched throughout the students' hall here in Exeter University. And we sent a message, a strong message, to everyone who has been affected by this statement that racism and fascism is not welcome in Exeter. It's never will be welcome in our campus. We will try and protect everyone who has been subjected to this sort of racism and fascism. And we are all like friends and colleagues. And we all like fight for what's just, basically. And it's really important that we unite our efforts for that reason.
We're speaking with Malika Muhammad. Malika, mainstream media outlets have also joined a pylon against you and other campaigners at Exeter. In a public statement, you wrote that, quote, the fact that mainstream media has, in an extremely one-sided way to date, reiterated these untruths gives further weight to the slurs and defamation. It will also have serious implications when I return to Gaza. Threats have already been sent to my family back home. Can you talk a little bit more about the threats that have been sent to your family, and if these kinds of attacks have deterred or will deter you from activism?
So, as I said, nothing is going to deter me. I'm going to keep doing what I think is right, and as soon as I have that inner sort of peace in myself, I'm going to do what I think is right. Now, the other part of your question is about the sort of like attacks and threats that I, along with others, have been receiving from people sometimes we don't know in social media. But beyond this like sort of hateful backlash that I have received, the unfounded charges against me will undoubtedly affect my freedom, which is very unfortunate. Countries don't need much of an excuse to refuse visas to Muslims. And as I said in my blog, that a simple Google search for me would reveal many of these abusive articles calling me all these like bad words. And as you've mentioned in your question, that like the media, actually like mainstream media here has reiterated these untruths. And it gives them like further weight and to this like sort of defamation that I've been exposed to. And for those who don't know like much about like what's going on in Gaza as well, Gaza is a Palestinian occupied territory according to the UN, and it has been under Israeli siege for or since 2006. All movements of people and goods in and outside of Gaza is controlled and heavily restricted by the Israeli military occupation. And if I should ever manage to get back to Gaza, I'm not sure if I'll be allowed again to leave. And this is, again, because of all this untruth that has been just widespread in the national media. Like, I'm not sure why the campaign against anti-Semitism is basically dedicated itself to attacking me. We do need a proper campaign here in England or like outside against anti-Semitism, but those people seems to work, instead of going against anti-Semitism, they seem like just to defend Israel and its crimes and attacking its critics with false accusations of anti-Semitism, which is very unfortunate again, but I will never be silenced by those who resort to misrepresentation and falsehoods and campaigning for Palestine, campaigning for justice everywhere, campaigning against racism, all forms of racism and discrimination will always be part of who I am. And I have an inner sort of peace in myself, and this is what I'm looking for. So as soon as I'm comfortable, as soon as I think that what I'm doing is right, I believe in the sort of like impact that our work is leading to here in the UK and outside, we will never be silenced. We will keep doing what we're doing because we think that is just and that is fair.
Finally, Malika, a letter of support was signed by more than 130 students and PhD researchers at Exeter expressing their solidarity with you. Can you talk about the letter and how you're moving forward right now?
Sure. There was a letter. So that is the only public letter that we had from Exeter students. Exeter students has been very supportive, especially here in the PhD space where I'm studying. They've mobilized the moment that these sort of like slurs and accusation has been in the media. In that day, there were like more than 130 students signing it. And then there were more letters from academics, like some of the academics in Exeter and outside Exeter, to the university and to the guild, also like expressing support and asking the university and the guild to stand and support like a student who is a member of the university and the guild and a trustee member, member of the trustee board as well. There were also like other emails and messages to the university from people that I've never met, which was really nice that they expressed support and they show that they stand with what is right and what is just and fair again. Now, how I'm moving, as I said, the first bit that I have in mind is that like all these sort of accusations to the university, asking the university to sack me or the guild to sack me from these three positions that I've been democratically elected to. So there was that investigation in the past few weeks. And as this investigation has been concluded and there's nothing against me, again, like the other thing that I'm now looking for is the legal advice. So I with other friends have been seeking some legal advice on that issue. We've also been complaining to the IBSO, which is the
Independent Press Standards Organization.
Yeah, so there was also complaints by friends and supporters to the IBSO. I also complained to the IBSO last week. There were also complaints to the Cherry Commission from lots of supporters as well for that. There's been so much support and I have been overwhelmed by all this from people that I know and people that I've never met or I've never known about, which is really good and really great. We need to make sure that we're all united against all these sort of attacks because I will not be the last one, I'm sure. All those people who attacked Malia in the beginning and attacking Jeremy Corbyn before and attacking me now, and they will keep attacking people who speak for justice and freedom and equality in Palestine. People who speak for BDS now, again, are being labeled the same way. So, we'll keep fighting.
Malika Mohammed, we're going to put your statement, your open statement, and links to the letters of support on the Electronic Intifada. Thank you so much for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast. And that's it for the Electronic Intifada podcast. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, and pointed opinion and analysis, visit us online at electronicintifada.net. where you can also post comments and sign up for our daily email digest. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and if you're listening on iTunes, support the Electronic Intifada podcast by rating it and leaving a review. On behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Gerald Friedman, professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts, who assesses the winners and losers in the proposed Republican Party health care plan. An excerpt of a speech by Joe Day Gowdy, chairman of the Yakama Nation in Washington State, delivered at the Native Nations Rise March and Rally in Washington, D.C. And L.A. Kaufman, a veteran organizer, strategist, journalist, and observer of U.S. radical politics, who talks about her new book titled Direct Action, which offers useful lessons for today's Trump resistance movement. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The smiling face of Donald Trump fills a billboard in the Serb-majority town of North Mitrovica, Kosovo. Serbs, who are a minority in Kosovo, were elated when Trump beat Hillary Clinton in last November's election. Many still hate Bill Clinton, who, as U.S. president in the 1990s, led bombing campaigns against Serb military forces in Bosnia and Kosovo during the violent breakup of the former Yugoslavia. Since a peace deal was signed in the Balkans, new ethnic tensions have resurfaced amid calls to reopen debate over borders and potential land swaps. In Bosnia, the autonomous Serb Republic regularly threatens to hold a referendum for independence. According to the Guardian newspaper, some Bosnian Serbs have supported the idea of boycotting the central government in Sarajevo, which has not accepted a ruling by the International Court of Justice, clearing Serbia of complicity in genocide during the Bosnian War. Conflicts between Albanians and Serbs never ended in the Balkans. One human rights activist observed, "It's Israel and Palestine in Europe." Western diplomats now worry 2017 may become a nightmare year with elections in Serbia and the growing likelihood of a snap poll in Kosovo. Indictments are also expected from a special court in The Hague, adjudicating crimes committed by members of the Kosovo Liberation Army, whose leaders now serve in Kosovo's political establishment. The U.S. Export-Import Bank has provided $315 million in financing to the New Jersey-based Connell Company, which sold equipment to mines in Africa accused of exploiting slave labor and of committing other human rights abuses. The financing deals from 2007 to 2015 involved 17 mining companies in sub-Saharan Africa. The Connell Company used U.S. taxpayer financing to supply equipment to the Bisha copper mine in Eritrea, which is under investigation by a Canadian court over accusations of using slave labor. The Canadian mining company Nevsun Resources, which runs the Bisha mine, faces a class action suit claiming Nevsun used the army to force military conscripts to work in their mine. The Connell Company, a family-owned conglomerate founded in 1926, is one of the largest recipients of financing from the Export-Import Bank, along with banking giants like Wells Fargo and J.P. Morgan Chase. According to the Center for Responsive Politics, the Connell Company donated almost $5.8 million to U.S. politicians from 1990 to 2016. After Donald Trump was nominated for president, Virginia activist Brittany Scherer decided it was time to commit to running for the state Senate. Scherer, an academic advisor at Old Dominion College, is not alone. Young women have flooded political training programs since Trump was elected in November, many concerned about reproductive rights and climate change. The new wave of feminist political activism comes just in time for the Democratic Party, which has lost control of the majority of state houses across the country. The current enthusiasm of women interested in running for local office is similar to what occurred in 1992, when the number of women candidates surged after the sexual harassment claims against Supreme Court Justice nominee Clarence Thomas were dismissed by the majority of the U.S. Senate. The number of women in public office has grown since the 1990s, but has flattened out in recent years. According to the Center for American Women in Politics at Rutgers University, women make up just 19% of the seats in Congress and only 25% of all state legislators. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
President Donald Trump and Republican Party leaders in the House and Senate have followed through on their campaign pledge to repeal and replace Obamacare. But the proposed GOP legislation, dubbed the American Health Care Act, shamelessly fails to live up to Trump's repeated promises on the campaign trail to provide health insurance to all Americans, ensure that all Americans will have quality health care for less money than Obamacare, and to never cut funding for Medicaid. On all three of those important pledges, the Republican health care bill flunks. Analysis of the legislation by the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office projects that 24 million more Americans would be uninsured by 2026 than under Obamacare, including 14 million that would lose their insurance by 2018. While the GOP bill would lower federal deficits by $337 billion over 10 years, largely as a result of cuts to Medicaid that would reduce enrollment, average health insurance premiums would rise by as much as 20% in 2018 and 2019 before falling in later years. If the Republican health care plan were to become law, an estimated 52 million people would be uninsured by 2026, compared to 28 million who lack insurance under the current law. More than 50 national organizations oppose the GOP's proposed health care plan endorsed by President Trump, including AARP, the American Medical Association, the American Hospital Association, the Federation of American Hospitals, and the American Cancer Society. Your reporter spoke with Gerald Friedman, professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, and an economic advisor to Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders during his presidential campaign. Here, Friedman assesses the winners and losers of the proposed Republican Party health care plan.
Well, the plan could very well be seen as wealth care instead of health care. The one definite element in the Republican plan that has persisted throughout all the various permutations is that they're going to repeal all the taxes that fund the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. And these are taxes that most people do not know about because they're only assessed on people earning over $250,000 a year. So they're getting rid of all the taxes, which is about $500 billion over the next decade. And all of that money is going to the top 1% of American households, most of it going to the top 1/100 of 1%. So those people are getting a lot of money. Now, since you're getting rid of the revenue, you have to find ways to cut spending. And they're doing it by doing away with the subsidies associated with the Affordable Care Act, subsidies that have gone to working people. They go to people earning less than four times the poverty line, which gets up to like $70,000 for families. And most of the subsidies go to people earning much, much less than that. Second, they are saving money by starting in 2020, basically phasing out the Medicaid expansion program that was part of the Affordable Care Act that mostly blue states, but a few Republican-dominated states, expanded Medicaid to cover people up to 140%, 138% of the poverty line, and also did away with all sorts of restrictions on Medicaid. And those two measures, the subsidies for people to buy individual health insurance plans and the Medicaid expansion, account for the dramatic drop in the proportion of Americans without health insurance. At this point, over 90% of Americans have health insurance. So the Affordable Care Act has worked to extend health insurance to people through subsidies for people to buy individual plans and Medicaid expansion, and those are both to be eliminated. The subsidies go right away, and the Medicaid expansion after 2020. Also, while they're doing this, things get even worse because they will be pulling the rug out from the whole market structure that's been set up. The Affordable Care Act, by subsidizing people to buy health insurance and requiring that people have health insurance, although that's a requirement that has never been enforced, has established a market for individual health insurance, for people to buy health insurance as individuals. That's a market that pretty much did not exist before, because health insurance companies would look at people like, why do you want to buy health insurance as an individual? It must be that you expect that you're going to be sick. The health insurance companies are ready to walk away from the individual marketplaces if there are no subsidies and no mandate. The Congressional Budget Office, they're all Republicans over there now. The Republicans took over the House and Senate a couple years ago, and they have full control over the Congressional Budget Office. So it's an old Bush administration economist. I'm sure he's competent, but their bias has been to downplay how bad this law is.
A quick question for you.
Yeah.
Several years ago, Dr. Steffi Wollhandler and David Himmelstein did a study that they published that talked about some 43,000 people would die if Obamacare was repealed because although there's lots of criticism to go around about the Obamacare system, it essentially gave people insurance and access to preventive health care and saved lives. Do we have any idea what will happen if 24 million people lose their insurance by 2026 under this Republican plan? How many people would lose their lives?
Yeah. Going back to the original study that Wollhandler, Himmelstein, and Wilper at Harvard Public Health did, I think it was 2003. I'm not totally sure of the year. But anyway, the original study, you'd basically figure 1,000 people die for every million people who lose health insurance. So if you have 24 million people thrown off health insurance, you'd be expecting about 24,000 more or less extra deaths in 2026. You'd expect 14,000 extra deaths next year. You know, put it in perspective, that's more than the number of Americans who died in 1967 in the Vietnam War. And we'd be doing that every year. People have to think about that, you know, in Congress. You know, how many Americans are you willing to kill?
I wanted to ask you about the possibility that this debacle in healthcare could result in some newfound political energy and popular support for Medicare for all, a single-payer system. Are you optimistic we are going to find ourselves moving towards single-payer in this country anytime soon?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, for two reasons. The first is the public energy, the resistance energy that's building up against the Trump administration and against the repeal of the Affordable Care Act. And second, destroying the Affordable Care Act is showing that we really need to do something dramatic to improve, to salvage healthcare in America.
That was Gerald Friedman, professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. Find more analysis of the proposed Republican healthcare plan and the single-payer alternative by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On March 10th, thousands of indigenous people from across the U.S. gathered in Washington, D.C. for the Native Nations Rise March and Rally. The action was preceded by 2 days of prayer and ceremony on the National Mall. The march route went past the Trump International Hotel, where some participants had erected a teepee, and a group of women did a circle dance. The event began as rain turned to snow, and then back to rain, which was described as Mother Earth doing exactly what she's supposed to be doing by a representative of the Piscataway Nation who welcomed everyone to her homeland. The days of protest and prayer were organized by the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, which continues to fight the Dakota Access Pipeline, as well as the Indigenous Environmental Network and the Native Organizers Alliance. Participants carried banners opposing the Dakota Pipeline, as well as signs calling for Native consent, and not just consultation, for invasive projects on their lands. Following an executive order from Donald Trump, the Dakota Access Pipeline is now proceeding to completion under the Missouri River. But the tribe is still engaged in a court fight to stop it. One of the speakers at a rally across from the White House was Joe Day Gowdy, chairman of the Yakama Nation in Washington State. He read from a proclamation signed by the Yakama and the Standing Rock Sioux tribe, which opposes what it calls the doctrine of Christian discovery that justifies the invasion and exploitation of native lands and peoples.
We carry a message and a warning here today. Love the earth. Love the waters of the earth. Love all forms of life. Care for them with deep and abiding honor and respect, and they will sustain you throughout time. However, be forewarned, if you poison and destroy them, they will poison and destroy you. That is natural law. Our ancestors bequeathed to us a sacred birthright of pure, pristine, and healing waters. Their prayerful and ceremonial manner of caring for the earth resulted in the purest rivers, springs, streams, and aquifers in the respective territories of our nations throughout this hemisphere. Our ancestors used their natural and innate intelligence to discern that water provides life force, the spirit upon all which life depends here on Mother Earth. Our ancestors were given and further evolved original instruction, natural laws, and wisdom teachings. Those instructions included the warning, remember, we follow in a prayerful manner these ceremonial and spiritual patterns of thought and behavior enable us to maintain a sacred and right relationship with the natural abundance of Mother Earth, interconnected with all life forms for all future generations. This is our life-sustaining message today. For more than 500 years, however, contrary forces of greed has worked to destroy our natural laws and our love for Mother Earth. They have greatly opposed our nations, our ceremonies, our teachings, and our sacred places in the name and in the idea that they call Christendom in Western Europe. The U.S. Supreme Court rulings and other U.S. actions have expressed these opposing forces, claiming a right of Christian sovereignty and dominion over the territories of the nations based upon the idea that Christian nations of Europe acquired jurisdiction over lands over heathens and infidels. The U.S. Justice Department made that exact argument in the U.S. Supreme Court case in 1954, Teton Indians versus the United States. The Justice Department even quoted Genesis 1:28 and the Book of Psalms from the Bible to support the claim of right Christian supremacy. This is a direct contradiction with the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution and the separation of church and state. We reject the pattern of thought and behavior premised on the Credo and Command, love riches and wealth, the Vatican Papal documents, and the colonizing royal charters written by self-described Christian monarchs that brought the Credo and Command here reveal the underlying code of domination and dehumanization used to attack our nations. The code of domination expressed a belief system that is willing to sacrifice everything on the altar of greed, even the sacred waters upon which life depends. To realize the unfortunate truth of this statement, one has to only think of the lead in the brains of the children of Flint, Michigan, where greed and disrespect for life destroyed rivers that once ran so pure you could drink from them, when our indigenous ancestors prayerfully cared for them since time immemorial. The government and corporate forces that oppose us have a great disdain for our organic laws and teachings, because the laws and teachings stand in the way of them fulfilling their love of riches and wealth. Those forces that oppose us are blind to the spiritual nature and the healing qualities of water. For them, water is simply a commodity, a means to create more riches and wealth, or a commodity to waste and destroy in search of riches and wealth. Therefore, we stand here today and offer the following statement as a proclamation. From the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe and the Yakima Nation, we will read this forth and we will call upon all Native nations and all original and free nations of this earth to stand and sign on to this proclamation with us. The original proclamation of life, original nations proclamation. We understand that our Creator has uniquely brought forth our existence. Our creation is of free and original origin, grounded in love and sustained by divine instruction, resulting in an existence and awareness that has materialized since time immemorial on Turtle Island. We understand the ideas of domination and dehumanization as these ideas are referenced within the divine instructions and warnings we have heeded since time immemorial for our sustained existence as original free peoples and nations. We understand that the inaccurate concept of discovery, formerly referred to as the doctrine of discovery, utilized by the monarchies of Spain and England, have unjustly manifested the idea of domination and dehumanization against our original free peoples and nations. We understand that the doctrine of discovery by historical monarchies was justified by unholy instruction issued by writ of papal bulls. We understand the dominating and dehumanizing force of manifest destiny utilized in the executive, legislative, and judicial formation of America. We understand the specific reference of the flawed and unholy idea of the doctrine of discovery in the origin of federal Indian law, cited in the Johnson versus McIntosh ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1823 and reaffirmed in 1955 by the Supreme Court ruling Teton Indians versus United States. We understand the judicial precedent of the unchallengeable domination that is being utilized by America's judicial, executive, and legislative branches in the modern-day disputes with original and free peoples and nations, such as Standing Rock's fight with the advocacy of clean water. We understand that the negative ideas of domination and dehumanization warned about to our collective original free peoples and nations by and through divine instruction is the same negative idea that has been utilized by the Roman Catholic Church, the monarchies of Spain and England, and the United States of America.
That was Joe Day Gowdy, chairman of the Yakama Nation. This segment was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. Find more information on the Native Nations Rise Action and organized indigenous resistance by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The 1960s and early 70s was a period of great turmoil and change in the U.S. and around the world. While the decade of the 1950s was identified with conformity and repression, symbolized by Senator Joe McCarthy's anti-communist witch hunts, the 1960s saw a blossoming of powerful social movements. Among these was the critical struggle against racism and for civil rights, massive protests to end America's wars in Southeast Asia, and the birth of new movements for women's equality and the coming out of the LGBT community. A new book, titled Direct Action, Protest and the Reinvention of American Radicalism by L.A. Kaufman, captures the voices of activists and leaders from a wide range of movements that have roots in the 1960s and 70s. The book traces the links between these radical movements over four decades and the evolution of strategies and tactics they employed to change the national debate and transform America. Importantly, Direct Action also highlights the central role of women and queer organizers, as well as the enduring racial divisions that have shaped progressive activism. Your reporter spoke with L.A. Kaufman, a veteran organizer, strategist, journalist, and observer of U.S. radical politics for more than 30 years, about the history covered in her new book, which she explains offers many useful lessons for today's Trump resistance movement.
When I look at the history of these movements and these organizing traditions unfolding over the course of this 40-year period, I see time and time again that the people who have functioned as the bridges between movements, who have brought the skills and the tactics and the organizing techniques, including some of the ones like affinity groups and spokes councils and consensus decision making, the people who have carried that knowledge and those practices from movement to movement have been disproportionately women and disproportionately queer women. And that is just an observation based on decades of being in movements, of who, if you look at the through lines from the anti-nuclear movement, commitment to the Central America work and then to ACT UP, for instance. Most of the men in ACT UP were political novices. It was the lesbians in ACT UP who were the folks who had done Central America work or who had been part of the women's peace encampments and brought all of these organizing skills. And so I think it's very fitting that, you know, as I say, it was kind of the kickoff party or the coming out for the resistance, the Women's March, which was, you know, really a decentralized mobilization. People really self-mobilized. It had many different voices in it, and is led by women. I've been incredibly, repeatedly surprised by the breadth and scope of the resistance that's emerging now. We're obviously facing an unprecedented challenge, but the scale and character of what I'm seeing is so different from anything I've seen in decades. It's so much broader. It's so much kind of livelier. It's coming in from so many unexpected quarters that although we're facing challenges like I've never seen, I feel encouraged that our movements are going to continue to resist strongly as Trump attempts to implement his policies and are going to be thinking very strategically about 2018 and 2020 and the longer road ahead.
In terms of the challenges for the Trump resistance movement, it seems that keeping up the high energy and the just incredible momentum that has built up in these last couple of months is difficult, is certainly a challenge, as well as sustaining that movement and that energy over the long haul. Do you have any advice for activists and organizers about the lessons that you've taken away from your living and working through the history of these last 40 years of radical movements?
Well, obviously people need to pace themselves and think about self-care and you know, be judicious in not burning themselves out in the short run. But there are times that require more of us, that ask us to do more and stretch ourselves farther. I think people are already doing that, and I think that's what we have to continue doing. We know that protest movements can be quite effective, and right now, civil society is the only check on the Trump administration, really, that there is. So I encourage people to, yes, be thoughtful about their participation so they can think about the long run, but to understand that these are such extraordinary times that it's a time for all of us to see what we can do to stretch ourselves and be a little bolder and really persist, because that's what victories come from.
That was L.A. Kaufman, a veteran organizer, strategist, journalist, and observer of U.S. radical politics for more than 30 years, talking about her new book titled Direct Action, Protest and the Reinvention of American Radicalism. Find links to Kaufman's website and related articles by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jabal's radio essay.
the discussing class. Sometimes a jewel of knowledge comes from the distant past and throws light on the present. It can come from unexpected sources. In the mid-1850s, a conservative political philosopher, Don Juan Donoso Cortez, wrote critically of the emerging modern state. He was especially critical of bourgeois liberalism, a social formation that he called una clase discutidora, a discussing class. According to Cortez, this class does not involve itself in social movements. It will not join social movements. It will write in the press and sometimes busy itself on political legislative efforts, but it will go no further. Its energies in social affairs is spent on conversation, period. It will not risk its privileges for other classes. As the Trump regime solidifies its grip on state power, we will hear discussions, sometimes quite critical, but discussions on Facebook or articles in the paper do not a movement make. Movements, real social movements, transform consciousness, which in turn contributes to social change, because changed minds feeds social movements. Social movements demand social change and struggle to make it so. Only social change makes it so. Discussion is not enough. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Of Philadelphia, but if you're in your 20s or 30s or even your 40s, you may be forgiven if you don't know the name. That's because he's perhaps best known as the man who was brutally punched, kicked, rifle-butted, and stomped by police when he got arrested. And this happened long before the infamous Rodney King police beating in Los Angeles. That's because Delbert was assaulted on video in August 1978, one of the earliest MOVE confrontations. Africa, like other MOVE members, have taught younger prisoners in ways to appreciate and become closer to their families. That sense of service, which is deep in MOVE, doesn't douse his fire. Listen for yourself.
My name's Delbert Africa from the MOVE organization. I just want to say the MOVE organization is a family of strong, serious, deeply committed revolutionaries founded by a wise, perceptive, strategically minded black man named John Africa. John Africa took each and every MOVE member from the weak body, sick, inactive, apathetic persons that we were and molded us into strong revolutionaries that are committed to doing away, eliminating this system, not reforming it, not changing the government, but eliminating this whole oppressive system.
Delbert Africa is a revolutionary who's just as steadfast in his belief as he was back in the 70s. That's because he's seen and experienced things that would astonish people. Remember that kicking and stomping I mentioned earlier? You ever wonder what happened to those cops caught on video? Well, in a word, nothing. But that's a story for another day. Velvet Africa issues a call to all social, radical, and revolutionary movements to keep on fighting. What I'm here today, thanks to Noel Hanrahan and Prison Radio, is a call for everybody else out there. I don't care who you are, to become and stay revolutionary. Because revolution is not a philosophy. It ain't a theory. It's an activity. If you still worshiping money, if you still doing drugs, if you abusing your mate, then you ain't revolting against this system. You helping this system keep this same thing going. And what I'm saying is, I want the Echo Warriors to keep on fighting. I want Black Lives Matter to keep on revolting. I want the animal liberationists to keep on fighting. Those who are defending the native lands out there in South Dakota against that oppressive pipeline, keep on fighting. Don't let this system put you down. I want everybody in the LGBTQ community, keep on fighting. Don't give in. This is what John Africa has taught MOVE, not to ever give in to this oppressive system. It don't matter about jail. It don't matter about prison. We know that we can keep on and we won't be stopped.
Velvet Africa specifically sent his salute to the Black Lives Matter movement, adding that he loved those young folks. He ain't alone in that. From Imprison Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap. Thank you.
what institutional incentives are there for Canada to keep promoting the nuclear industry? Have partnerships with the United States and the nuclear deal with India restricted the ability of Canada to get off of nuclear? How safe are Canadian and American-based reactors from a Fukushima-style incident? What role did money play in affecting the response by Japanese authorities to the Fukushima Daiichi disaster? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we continue a conversation on the state of the nuclear industry and nuclear power 6 years after the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear catastrophe by speaking with two experts. First up, Gordon Edwards of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility explains the Canadian government's 70-year embrace of the atom. And later, Arnie Gunderson of Fairwinds Energy Education discusses the state of nuclear reactors and regulation in both Canada and the U.S. before bringing us up to date on the Japanese government's efforts to protect the public as well as the nuclear sector. On this week's program, Managing the Nuclear Risk, 6 years after Fukushima, conversations with Gordon Edwards and Arnie Gunderson. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of March 17th, 2017. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, an occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Donald Trump's $1 trillion infrastructure plan is not an infrastructure plan, and it won't put $1 trillion to fiscal stimulus into the economy. It's basically a scheme for handing over public assets to private corporations that will extract maximum profits via user fees and tolls. Because the plan is essentially a boondoggle, it will not lift the economy out of the doldrums, increase activity, or boost growth. Quite the contrary. When the details of how the program is going to be implemented are announced, public confidence in the Trump administration is going to wither and stock prices are going to plunge. That comes from the article, Trump's $1 trillion infrastructure boondoggle, handing over public assets to private corporations, by Mike Whitney, posted March 16th, originally appearing at Counterpunch. As the infamous big lie reasoning goes, if you keep repeating a falsehood over and over again, people will sooner or later believe it. And so Kagame relentlessly went on a global stage and repeatedly lied that he had built an economic powerhouse. He had a motive. He believed that if he convinced his international supporters that he was creating prosperity in Rwanda, that they would tolerate his human rights abuses. In other words, Kagame sold them a trade-off. He told them that Rwandan people are more interested in food and jobs than democracy and human rights. That comes from an interview with David Himbara, conducted by Ann Garrison, under the headline, Kagame's Economic Mirage in Rwanda, posted March 16th. Indeed, the West's involvement in Syria by its very nature puts the blood of every individual killed in that conflict squarely on the hands of the Western nations that engineered the crisis to begin with. Without the West, there would have been no quote-unquote revolution, no moderate cannibals, and no armed conflict whatsoever. But it is important to point out here that what Eva Bartlett witnessed was Western journalists who were clearly exposed to the same facts and incidents as herself, but who returned to their writing desks to report the opposite, or at the very least, something so skewed and misrepresented that it might as well have been a bald-faced lie. Others who have traveled to Syria have also found that their Western counterparts were reporting stories vastly different from their actual experiences.
So while the mainstream media maligns Ava Bartlett as a Russian agent, the truth of the matter is that the corporate outlets are agents of disinformation and propaganda, as more and more Americans are beginning to learn by the day. That comes from the article, Corporate Media Exposed for Reporting Syria Misinformation, Canadian journalist Ava Bartlett, by Brandon Turbeville, posted March 16th, originally appearing at Activist Post. Campaigner Dr. Rosemary Mason has just written an open letter to the global pesticide regulatory authorities and the UK and US media. To make her case, Dr. Mason draws on that report as well as new findings and revelations that have emerged thus far in 2017. Over the past few years, in her numerous documents, Mason has described the devastating effects of agrochemicals and has singled out certain individuals who should be standing in the dock to answer for their roles they have played in poisoning the environment and damaging public health. She has supplied strong evidence to highlight how agrochemicals are killing us and how public institutions and governments collude with the industry to frame legislation and policies. That comes from the article, Stop Protecting the Criminality of the Global Pesticides Industry, by Colin Todd Hunter, posted March 16th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Joining us now to put the Fukushima disaster and the nuclear industry in the Canadian context, we're joined by Gordon Edwards. He's the president of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Can you give us some background on your organization?
Well, my organization was founded back in 1975 as a result of two major events. One was the first explosion of an atomic bomb by India using plutonium from a Canadian nuclear reactor that was given to India as a gift in 1974. And then in 1975, there was the discovery of extensive radioactive contamination in the town of Port Hope, Ontario, where a lot of the uranium for the World War II atomic bomb project had been processed. And they had to evacuate an elementary school called St. Mary's School because of the very high radon gas levels in the cafeteria, which were higher than those allowed in uranium mines. And then they discovered that hundreds of towns and buildings were radioactively contaminated because of the use of radioactive material as building material given to the townspeople and the construction workers by a federally owned Crown corporation, El Dorado Nuclear, which was simply telling their workers that they could help themselves to the radioactive waste and use it for whatever purpose they wished. So that was what led to the formation of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility in Montreal here in the basement of 2010 McKay Street, which was connected to Concordia University, where Fred Nelman was the professor of science and human affairs there. And I was the, at that time, I was the adjunct professor of science and human affairs. And there were about 30 of us gathered in the basement of 2010 McKay Street. And we decided that we needed to form a national organization that would have two purposes. One would be to act as a clearinghouse for information on nuclear issues for communities and groups across Canada, and the second would be to form a united front calling on the Government of Canada to open a public inquiry into the costs, risks, and benefits of nuclear power, because we felt that if there was an inquiry into this whole topic, that we had no doubt that the Canadian parliamentarians and the Canadian public would decide that it's not the path which Canada should be pursuing. However, the government of Canada has never had such an inquiry in its entire life, and the actual subject of nuclear power and nuclear policy has never actually been debated in the House of Commons. So we have a policy here which was brought in during World War II in secrecy, with billions and billions, tens of billions of dollars spent of federal money subsidizing and creating, in fact, the nuclear industry in Canada and the uranium industry without any real democratic process.
It seems as if, yes, something I've noticed is that there's been a lot of boosterism for the nuclear industry within Canada. And certainly, you know, Canada is like a major, I think, the second largest exporter of uranium in the world. And there's, you know, the CANDU reactors that have been constructed over the years. But I'm wondering, you know, looking at that historical perspective, what are the main institutional forces that you would say that seems to have incentivized this nuclear industry within the country?
Well, during World War II, Canada was approached by first the British and then the Americans to enter into a top-secret agreement to collaborate on the World War II atomic bomb project. And this was twofold in nature. One was the fact that Canada had the only freely available source of uranium that could be immediately applied to a nuclear weapons program. And that was because of a historical fact that we had a private company based in Ontario, had opened a radium mine in Northwest Territories on Great Bear Lake, way up just near the Arctic Circle, at a place called Port Radium. And radium happens to be a byproduct, a radioactive byproduct of uranium. And so where there is radium, there is uranium. Now, for about 10 years, radium was processed at Port Hope, Ontario, in a refinery there. And there were lots of wastes that were stored in, well, some of the wastes were dumped in the harbor, some were stored in ravines. There were deep ravines around town, and it was just dumped into the ravines. They also had, in some cases, farmer silos that were filled up with radioactive waste. But this radioactive waste contained uranium, which had no commercial value at the time. So it was the radium that they were extracting and leaving the uranium behind. That meant that when they discovered in 1939, when they discovered that you could possibly make a powerful atomic bomb using uranium, where can you find uranium? Well, Czechoslovakia is one place, but that had been invaded by the Nazis. And Belgian Congo was another place where they had rich uranium deposits, but the Belgium had been overrun by the Nazi war machine. So the only place that really you could find available uranium was Canada. So Canada supplied the uranium and also nationalized this private company, which had been called Eldorado Gold Mining, and they changed it to Eldorado Nuclear Limited. But this was all done without any parliamentary debate. It was all done in great secrecy. And C.D. Howe, who was then the minister who was really running things in the Canadian government for Mackenzie King, the prime minister, he told Parliament that certain things were being done and that he would appreciate it if there were no questions, and indeed there were no questions. And so he just went ahead and did this. At the same time, there was an agreement to transfer from Britain to Canada the research team that was researching the production and separation and use of plutonium, which is another man-made nuclear explosive. Uranium is the only material in nature from which you can make an atomic bomb. But some of the uranium, when it's put into a nuclear reactor, some of that uranium is transmuted into a man-made material called plutonium. And that's an even more powerful nuclear explosive than uranium-235. So scientists that were top nuclear scientists from Britain, from France, and from a few other parts of Europe came to Mount Royal here in Montreal, and they worked on the slopes of Mount Royal in a secret laboratory starting in about 1942. And they researched the best ways to produce plutonium and the best ways to separate plutonium. And the experience that was undertaken there in Montreal, not very far from where I live, as a matter of fact, just a walking distance, this is what gave Britain and France their head starts on their own bomb programs. Because after World War II, they went back to their own countries and they embarked upon implementing the knowledge they had gained. It's also why Britain and France both had a great advantage in the technology of plutonium separation, plutonium reprocessing. It's why Britain and France became the reprocessing giants of the world at that in those early days. Meanwhile, there was a permission given to build the first nuclear reactor in Canada at Chalk River. This decision was made in Washington, D.C. Around Christmas of 1944. And the purpose of that reactor was to produce plutonium for bombs. In fact, there's a bronze plaque at Chalk River, Ontario, saying that this is where the first Canadian nuclear chain reaction occurred, and that the purpose of this research was initially to produce plutonium for bombs. In fact, for many years afterwards, we sold all of our uranium and all of our plutonium to the United States military, specifically for weapons purposes. Up until 1965, our Canadian uranium sector, mining sector, we had hundreds of mines after the war, and it was all for weapons purposes because that was the only market there was. So up until 1965, all of our uranium was sold for military, for weapons, for the weapons buildup in the United States. And at that time, we were the largest producers and exporters of uranium in the world. In 1965, Prime Minister Pearson declared that Canada would no longer sell uranium for weapons purposes. By that time, the military contracts had already dried up. The biggest production of uranium for military purposes was in 1959, at which time it was the fourth largest export from Canada after timber, pulp and paper, and wheat came uranium. And as I say, it was all for bombs.
Mm. So that's clearly the military aspects of it seem to be a major driver here. And I know that currently there's about 19 active nuclear plants in Canada. I mean, I think all but one are in the province of Ontario. So,
right.
How is the situation looking now? Because we're seeing. And I don't know to what extent this is just public relations or if this is an actual phenomenon, but there's a lot of talk about using nuclear to offset or to help meet our Paris climate goals. I even have a quote here from the Minister of Natural Resources speaking to the Canadian Nuclear Association's annual conference just a couple of weeks ago. He said, quote, "Canada is one of only 9 mission innovation countries to include nuclear energy as part of its clean energy portfolio. The inclusion of nuclear energy should tell you something about the importance of your industry and how mission innovation is an opportunity for you to demonstrate that nuclear energy can contribute to Canada's clean innovation landscape." So what does that say to you looking forward?
Well, it's unfortunate that our government is so blinkered on the subject. They have never had any advice, independent advice, on the subject of nuclear power going forward. They have allowed the nuclear industry to basically run public policy so that the Canadian government does more or less does what the nuclear industry tells them to do rather than vice versa. And in fact, it's been a spectacle in the past where our prime ministers have been, in effect, can-do salesmen. Even Prime Minister Trudeau's father, Pierre Elliott Trudeau, when he was prime minister, was running around the world, and one of his main missions was to try and sell CANDU reactors to anybody who would consider buying them. And the reason for this is because this is an industry that was created with public money by the Canadian government. And so there has been no separation, really, between the government and the industry. You couldn't put a playing card between them. They're so close. So it's unfortunate that that's the case because, in fact, if you stand back and look at nuclear power, you realize that it cannot really solve the global warming problem. Right now, it used to produce about 17% of world electricity back around the turn of the millennium, but it's now down to about 10% and dropping. And so nuclear power is definitely decreasing and will continue to decrease. Even promoters of nuclear power, such as the International Atomic Energy Agency, whose mandate is primarily to promote nuclear power, even they admit that the nuclear decline, the decline in nuclear share of energy production, will continue at least for the next 20 to 30 years. And the reason for that is because we have about 450, 440 nuclear reactors worldwide, and they're shutting down faster than any new ones can possibly be built. There are new ones being built, but they do not even replace the old ones that are being shut down. So here in Canada, for example, we have less nuclear reactors operating than we had 10 years ago. In the United States, there are fewer nuclear reactors operating than there were 10 years ago. France is shutting down nuclear reactors, and we're seeing in the Western world, there's no doubt that there's a very sharp decline underway. In the East, when you look to the Orient, you see China, and of course Japan had 54 nuclear reactors, which were all shut down 2 years after the accident, every single one of them. And now only two of them are operating, have been restarted. The other ones, some of them may be restarted, but they certainly will not all be restarted, maybe a third at the very most. And there's a lot of opposition to restarting them in Japan as well. Now, India, it has ambitious plans, but they're having a lot of problems, too. They had a nuclear accident just last year in one of their CANDU clones. They have about 15 CANDU reactors, 13 of which are their own clones. What I mean by that is that they copied the design of the reactors we gave them and made more reactors of a similar design because we had cut off nuclear cooperation with them after they used the plutonium in our first reactor to produce atomic bombs. And, of course, they have developed atomic bombs. They have not signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty. They are, in that sense, a rogue nation. They have no indication of stopping to produce atomic bombs, and yet the Harper government signed an agreement with India to sell them uranium. Mm. So it means that Canada, it really doesn't care much whether you have atomic bombs or not. We'll sell you uranium anyway, which sends a very bad signal to the entire world.
I'm also curious in that vein. I mean, we have a very special partner in the United States, while Obama was president, there was a special memorandum of understanding on concerning climate change and energy collaboration, which sought to expand cooperation on energy and collaboration activities. And also now we've got Trump in power, and he's been quoted as saying that we must greatly strengthen and expand, or America must greatly strengthen and expand its nuclear capability until such time as the world comes to its senses regarding nukes. So, I mean, I'm wondering, given existing partnerships between Canada, the United States, military, energy, and so on, if our hands aren't tied so that we, even if we wanted to, we would be restricted in our ability to, reduce our focus on nuclear power and nuclear energy.
We have no pressure from the United States to keep our nuclear power industry going. That's entirely our concern. Uranium might be a different matter, but even there, America has, the United States has developed its own indigenous supplies of uranium. I don't think that's a legitimate point of view. It's true that Canada is in a delicate position with regard to the United States, and we do have NORAD, which is a North American command, which does govern nuclear weapons in terms of the defense of the United States of America, because the defense of the United States of America implies that they have to help to defend Canada, because originally it was thought that if there was going to be a nuclear war between Russia and the United States, that the missiles would fly over Canada. And so even when I was a young fellow, we had, at that time, we only had bombers. You know, we had bombers in the air all the time, loaded with nuclear weapons, as portrayed in that Stanley Kubrick movie, Dr. Strangelove, wonderful movie. So we had in Canada the Dew Line, the distant early warning sign, which is a radar chain across Arctic Canada to detect any bombers coming in from Russia. Of course, those days are largely past. We still have the bombers, yes, but now they have these missiles which can deliver weapons in a very short time. And we have nuclear submarines which can, one Trident submarine is capable with its nuclear payload, its nuclear weapons, of wiping out every major city in the Northern Hemisphere. So these are incredibly powerful. And in terms of the Hiroshima bomb, which destroyed the city of Hiroshima and killed 100,000 people immediately and many more later, they don't make bombs that small anymore. I mean, even the smallest bomb that would fit inside the nose cone of a cruise missile, one of those self-piloted planes, as it were, that follows the terrain rather low to the ground and delivers its missile very accurately, even those warheads are 15 times more powerful than the Hiroshima bomb. So, you know, we're talking here about a real case of institutional insanity. Now, Russia, after the end of the Cold War, Russia and the United States of America, who have between them by far the greatest arsenals, they had deep cuts to their strategic nuclear missiles, and they dismantled many thousands of these weapons, so that but we still have 15,000 left, and 5,000 of them are on more or less hair trigger alert. They could be launched within a matter of 2 minutes, and once launched, they cannot be recalled. There's no way to call them back again, and so we do have the power to make this planet pretty well uninhabitable within a matter of an afternoon. And even if there was a limited nuclear war, the same scientists who study global warming, the same computer models which are used to study what happens when carbon dioxide or other pollutants are introduced into the atmosphere, have demonstrated that even a limited nuclear war involving just a few dozen nuclear weapons on each side, let's say between India and Pakistan, would be enough to cause so much ash, inject so much ash into the atmosphere that we would have agricultural problems, severe agricultural problems in the whole Western Hemisphere for several years afterwards, and this could lead to tremendous hardships and starvation because we wouldn't be able to grow the food that we need. So that's only a small nuclear war. When you talk about a big nuclear war, it's not only the destruction of civilization, it's really the destruction of most higher forms of life. So to call this a weapon, when really it's part of a suicide machine, is very short-sighted, and it means, you know, that Albert Einstein was absolutely right when he said so many years ago that the splitting of the atom has changed everything except our way of thinking, and that's why we are drifting towards unparalleled catastrophe.
Well, on that somewhat gloomy note, I want to thank you very much, Gordon Edwards, for sharing your thoughts with us.
Bye-bye.
Thanks a lot.
We've been speaking with Gordon Edwards, president of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility. The group's website is www.ccnr.org. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca.
As noted on last week's program with Helen Caldicott, the Fukushima disaster is not over, but is an ongoing catastrophe. There are lessons to be learned to prevent future mishaps, but are they sinking through? One person ideally suited to address such questions is Arne Gundersen. Mr. Gundersen is one of the directors of Fairwinds Energy Education, a Burlington, Vermont-based information hub which educates the public around nuclear issues. Mr. Gundersen is a nuclear engineer with over 44 years of experience in the industry. He graduated cum laude from the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute and holds a master's degree in nuclear engineering, which earned him a prestigious Atomic Energy Commission fellowship. He holds a nuclear safety patent, was a licensed reactor operator, and is a former nuclear industry senior vice president. Over the course of his career, he's managed and coordinated projects at 70 nuclear power plants in the U.S. Mr. Gundersen, it's a great privilege to have you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thanks. I'm glad to be here.
Mr. Gundersen, we just concluded a conversation with Gordon Edwards about some of the forces shaping Canada's nuclear industry. The Canadian Nuclear Association boasts of the safety of the sector, saying on its website, quote, "Though Canada's nuclear facilities have been shown to be both safe and reliable, the industry cooperates with the CNSC, that's our nuclear regulatory agency, to limit the effects of any potential accident on the public and the environment. Notwithstanding, there was at least one reactor catastrophe in 94, the Pickering facility, among the 19 plants in operation currently in Canada. Are there any that you think could have the propensity for impacts comparable to Fukushima?
You know, I think the Pickering reactors are the biggest problem in Canada. And the reasons are twofold. The first is that it's so darn near to major population centers. You know, in the States, we're worried about Indian Point, which is 25 miles from New York City, but Pickering's right on the outskirts of Toronto, and with even less distance. So Pickering's in trouble because of emergency planning. But the other thing is, and they actually admitted this in hearings that when I brought it up, the Pickering design is designed for one reactor having a problem. They have this thing called a vacuum building, and the vacuum building is designed to handle one nuclear accident at a time. But if a Fukushima event came along and disabled two or three of them, the vacuum building is not adequate, and there would be an enormous radiation release. And actually, the people that run Pickering and the regulator agreed that that part of the design is much weaker than reactors in the States. You know, I have this saying, sooner or later, in any foolproof system, the fools are going to exceed the proofs. And whether it's a Canadian design or, you know, we've had a Babcock Wilcox design fail at Three Mile Island, a Russian design fail at Chernobyl, a General Electric design fail in Japan. So for the Canadians to say, well, we haven't had one, so therefore we're safe, they're not safe, they're just lucky. And sooner or later, you're going to roll snake eyes. And a reactor is going to melt down, and at that point, it's too late to make these grandiose claims.
Hmm. Now, in the United States, according to the International Atomic Energy Agency, there are 99 operational nuclear reactors in the U.S., while 34 have been permanently shut down. Could some weird weather event, earthquake, or even a terrorist attack trigger another Fukushima-style event among one of these reactors? Or can Americans have confidence in the nuclear regulatory authorities learning the lessons of Fukushima and not replicating them?
You know, we're always fighting the last war, before Fukushima, we thought we had learned from Chernobyl, and before Chernobyl, we thought we had learned from Three Mile Island. And I think the lesson is that these are very complicated machines, and they fail in different ways. So the nuclear industry in the States, on a shoestring, they're really not spending as much money as they should, have implemented some Fukushima mods, as have the Canadians and around the world, for that matter. People have modified their plants for Fukushima-type events. But you know, it seems to me that every accident has been unimaginable. And just because we say, well, my plant is in the middle of Oklahoma and we don't have tsunamis out here, therefore we're safe, is a little bit crazy. We're bound to have a problem. I'm concerned with a lot of aging things, and whether it's you know the Canadian CANDU designs or the American designs, all these things were designed. The fundamental design work was in the 60s, and most of the procurement was in the 70s. So you're dealing with really old equipment now, and that's been under high temperature, high pressure, and oh by the way, high radiation for 40 years. And we just don't know what we don't know. So something else is going to come along. We have a couple problems here in the States. We have a power plant right down from a major dam, the Oconee 123 units. And if the dam fails, the units will be under 20 feet of water, which is an event just like Fukushima out in Diablo Canyon in California. They're on a spur of the San Andreas fault that wasn't discovered until after the plants were built. So, you know, there seems to be a problem everywhere that we seem to ignore and kind of whistle past the graveyard.
I know that Fukushima reactors were the General Electric's Mark I reactors, and I know the United States uses many of that same model. Have they, at least with regard to the problems with that system, I mean, for example, the spent fuel pools being located above ground, and, you know, are there any, you know, people looking at some of the design flaws and saying, okay, maybe we need to make changes here in the United States?
You know, a bunch of those, there's 23 identical to Fukushima in the United States, and a bunch of those drain into the Great Lakes. There's 40 nuclear power plants that discharge into the Great Lakes. So if we have a problem here in the States, you're going to feel it in Canada, because it can easily make the Great Lake water sources unusable for 40 million people. So one Fukushima lesson is that the Pacific is a big place, and we're still contaminating it. The Great Lakes are probably 20,000 times smaller. So if we have a nuclear disaster along one of these plants that drains into the Great Lakes, both our countries will have a contaminated water supply for decades. You know, but in the States, we have not moved the fuel pools. They're still seven stories high, and they're still unprotected. And more importantly, the containment designs have not been really modified. What we did in the States is we put a pipe in the side of the containment with a valve, and we keep it open. So the position is, well, we have a containment, but if we keep that valve closed, it won't contain because it will blow up. So let's turn this valve and open our containment. And it's hard to claim it's a containment then, and let that radioactive gas out so the containment doesn't fail. And we call that containment venting. And one of the modifications from Fukushima was to put this pipe in and put a valve in and allow it to be open in the event of a nuclear accident to exhaust those radioactive gases rather than blowing up the building.
Mm. Okay. That's sort of like the pressure cooker
Yeah, let's drill a hole in the lid of our pressure cooker so the pressure cooker doesn't blow up. That's
right.
Basically,
that solves the problem.
That's the American solution, right?
American way. Now, it seems to me the public is, by and large, losing its appetite for nuclear. It's expensive. It generates all this waste. And there's the threat of another Fukushima, of course. And assuming we could get the government and authorities to comply with, say, an all-out ban on nuclear, what are the technical and some of the economic and jurisdictional impediments that one would face in shutting down and ultimately decommissioning these nuclear reactors?
Yeah, of course, the big impediment to building new ones is money. Wall Street is not interested in funding another nuclear power plant. The only nukes that are being built right now are in countries that have an authoritarian government. and the government is backing it up. So we are just not seeing new nukes being built anywhere. You know, in Canada, now they're talking about extending the lives of the plants that are part of Ontario Hydro. And in fact, it would be cheaper to get the power from Quebec with all of the hydroelectric they have there than keep the nuclear plants running. So you have an outstanding example of a institutional impediment. You know, there's about 20 plants in Ontario, and the Ontario government is so pro-nuclear that they'll distort the economy so that they can keep these plants running. And the average plant costs about $1 billion to knock down, and you know there's 400 of them worldwide. So you're looking at about $400 billion in the cost to dismantle these plants. It's the only growth industry in nuclear power right now is the decommissioning of nuclear. There's two types of waste. There's some waste that decay away in a couple hundred years, and you can sort of imagine if you stuck those wastes in the middle of a desert, like we are here in the States, it's possible that they'll stay out of harm's way for a couple hundred years. But then there's the other waste, which is the spent fuel. And that stays radioactive for a quarter of a million years. And the Canadian design is actually worse than the American design. The CANDU plants generate a lot more plutonium than the American design. So that, which is a bomb material and which is toxic. And, oh, by the way, it's also carcinogenic as well. So, the Canadian problem is actually pound for pound worse than the American problem because of all this excess plutonium. Now, there's a great movie and it's called, Into Eternity. And I think you can get it online. It's about the Finns are building a high-level waste repository, and it's about the design of the Finnish reactor, the cave, rather, that's going to hold the spent fuel. And they were discussing, you know, how language changes. I mean, we have a hard time reading Shakespeare, let alone the old Beowulfs and things like that. So if you put a sign over this thing and say, don't dig here, it's really bad stuff below the surface, well, 1,000 years from now, people are not going to be able to read that because language changes. But the flip side of that is if you put a sign there and you get the next Stalin or Hitler to come along who wants that stuff because he can make bombs out of it, they're going to dig there. So what do you do with this waste? Do you warn people or do you hope everybody forgets and it stays there? It's a fascinating movie called Into Eternity.
I wanted to move on to Japan and the anniversary of the Fukushima disaster. Now, I know that last year you were in Japan, and the government, which seems to be quite determined to bring back their nuclear energy, but you surveyed the damage, you recorded the radiative levels throughout the country, and I'm kind of curious to know what stood out for you most about what you found while you were there and how the Japanese people were responding and adapting to the situation.
Well, my takeaway from the trip, looking back, and it was a year ago, and I was there for a month, the inhumanity of the Japanese government and Tokyo Electric to their own people's needs is mind-boggling. I ran into a woman who was 3 miles from the disaster and had to evacuate, and she lost her hair. Her nose bled for 2 months, and she was covered with speckles from sort of like sores all over her body. And her doctor wrote it down as stress. And that's what's happening in Japan right now. The doctors who write down radiation as the root cause of these problems are losing their hospital privileges, and they're losing the they're not being reimbursed for these illnesses. But if they write stress, they get reimbursed and they can still be doctors. The epidemiological problem there is that scientists like me and others trying to go back over these records, there are none, because all of the radiation-related fatalities are being and injuries are being written off as stress. So, you know, my big takeaway is the inhumanity of how the Japanese and how Tokyo Electric are treating their own people. You know, related to that is Japan had 54 nukes running on the day of the disaster, and four were at Daiichi and were permanently damaged. But there were still, you know, roughly 50 that could have been started back up. And what the Japanese banks have done for the last 6 years, Japan has shut them all down. But they have a highly experienced cadre of people at these sites, and it costs about $1 billion a year to pay the salaries and the infrastructure to keep these plants viable. So there's, you know, do the math. There's 50 plants at $1 billion. The Japanese banks are paying $50 billion a year to keep these plants viable. Well, no bank does that unless they're sure they're going to get their money back. 6 years times 50, they're in this for $200 or $300 billion. So now the pressure is the banks want their money back, and the pressure is to get these plants started again so they can get their money back. And the pressure on the politicians is astronomical to allow these plants to start back up. This on the most populous, seismically active island in the world.
That seems to be one hell of a nuclear addiction they have, that they're spending that kind of money to provide those sorts of incentives. On the technical front, could you talk, you know, given your knowledge about, you know, your overview of the ways in which TEPCO, the operator of these of the Fukushima plant, and then Japanese authorities, the way they should have responded to the disaster once it was underway.
Yeah, and this is a common element for Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, and Fukushima. Bureaucracies don't want to evacuate people. Now, I was on CNN saying it's unconscionable not to evacuate out to 30 or 40 kilometers, and the Japanese were evacuating out to 3 kilometers. And I said it was unconscionable not to get rid of, not to get the women and children out of those areas and even further out. And the Japanese didn't do anything there either. It happened at Three Mile Island, where the government, U.S. government, and the owner basically colluded to convince people that the problem was not as severe. It happened at Chernobyl for the first 5 days, until finally world pressure got the government to evacuate. And it happened at Fukushima. So governments would rather risk the life of a person than call for an evacuation. So, you know, shame on Tokyo Electric. And, you know, I got to spend some time with Naoto Kan, who was the prime minister at the time. He's a nice guy. He and I have been on a couple of speaking tours. And I said to him, Prime Minister Kan, you're not a nuclear engineer, and I can understand how, given the information you had, you made the decisions you did. The Japanese hate him because he didn't evacuate. But he was getting crappy information. So anyway, he said to me back, he looked at me and he said, thank you. And this is through an interpreter. He said, the information I received was neither accurate nor timely. So they weren't even telling the prime minister of Japan on a real-time basis accurate information. So, you know, it's just hideous. This nuclear priesthood is more interested in maintaining its own orthodoxy rather than admitting that things are seriously wrong. Mm.
Now, I wanted to bring up a technical question with you, and that sprung up from all those Freedom of Information documents that were disclosed months after the incident in which the National Regulatory Commission officials discussed the crisis in real time. There were phone conversations and emails making reference to the spent fuel pools, particularly Fuel Pool 4. One official report mentioned projecting a source term of 100% of the spent fuel from Unit 4 being released into the atmosphere. There's another mentioning U4, the Unit 4 situation is deteriorating. SFP water inventory is lost. In the March 16th conference call, the explosion leveled the walls, leveled the structure for the Unit 4 spent fuel pool all the way down to the approximate level of the bottom of the fuels, so there's no water in there whatsoever. And what we were told, even by Dr. Caldicott last week, was that the spent fuel from Unit 4 was recovered and stored carefully. So if these officials were speaking so matter-of-factly about the loss of water in spent fuel 4 and the zirconium fires, from, you know, the reactions in the water and such, how do you make sense of these apparently conflicting accounts?
Yeah, that's a great question. And there's a series of FOIA requests that show that the United States government was terrified that Fukushima was, I think one of them said, a utter catastrophe. That was one of the key people is actually saying an utter catastrophe. There's another one where a key person at the NRC said the Fukushima Daiichi containment is the worst in the world. Well, if it was the worst in the world 3 days after the accident, why wasn't it the worst in the world 3 years before? Part of the problem is it wasn't as bad as the emails suggest. And I think part of that, a lot of these are in the first 2 or 3 days after the disaster. So some of that, to coin the phrase, it's a fog of war thing, that they were getting lots of reports, and some of them turned out to be, factual, not as bad as the emails made them out to be. There was no total loss of water inventory in the spent fuel pool. But, you know, here's a fascinating thing that no reporter has ever checked out. At Fukushima Unit 4, emergency repairs were made in the 2 months after the nuclear disaster. So this is the site is radioactive as all get out. And the first thing Tokyo Electric did was install extra bracing in the bottom, in the fuel pool bottom, the floor, which is actually the ceiling, the floor of the pool, but they put jacks underneath the floor to hold it up. And why did they do that? Why was that their first priority? So was the Unit 4 fuel pool in jeopardy? Oh, yeah. I was on John King, on CNN, and I said they had about a day to get water in that pool. They got water in time to prevent it from burning, but yet there's this side story that you and I have never been made aware of. Why did they brace the bottom of that pool if everything was okay? I don't think the fuel came out perfectly clean either. You know, the fuel has been removed, but they never talked about damage or having to pull the fuel too hard or things like that. And we still have three pools to go, which are even, in fact, worse than the Unit 4. Mm. So to answer your question, it's a fog of war issue. A lot of reports are coming in the first couple of days. And then there was a stroke of luck. This is you have to, like Naoto Kan said, you've got to believe in God or something like that. When the fuel pool was split at Fukushima. And on one side was equipment being stored that had to go back in the nuclear reactor. And on the other side was the fuel, which is hot and physically boiling off the fuel. And in between them was a gate. And the gate was held in place by like a rubber tire, like a rubber bike tire. And it was inflated. And that pool on the equipment side, that had been scheduled to be drained 3 days before, but it wasn't. And a day or two after the accident, as the water levels are coming down and the fuel is about ready to catch fire. The air pressure in that seal failed and that wall collapsed, allowing the clean water on the one side to flood into the spent fuel pool, and it bought them a couple more days. So it was, I don't believe in divine intervention, but it certainly was fortuitous that they were behind schedule and didn't drain that second pool. So there were, this could have been much worse. If that pool had caught fire, northern Japan would have been uninhabitable forever. And, the Vancouver and it would be highly contaminated, as would be important down to Portland and things like that. But we know that didn't happen because the radiation levels on site still allowed human beings to be there. If that pool had caught fire, the staff would have died. But while that was happening, they're telling us on the radio, they have all these reports saying, we got a catastrophe on our hands. And we're being told, and the Japanese were being told, and I'm sure the Canadians were too, don't worry, it's under control. Shame on the bureaucracy for behaving that way.
I guess I only have time for one more question, and I guess that relates to the trip last year where I saw some of the images of your trip, and there was like an image of you with the respiratory mask and in front of these abandoned radioactive ghost towns and scenes in the background, and it came across as a little eerie to me, and it made me wonder if we weren't getting a glimpse of the future, not just for Japan, but for the whole planet with these... in the age of nuclear, as we can't seem to back away. I was wondering if any of those sorts of morbid thoughts may have come to your mind.
The mask that I was wearing is a $30 mask. It's not a real expensive mask, but it removes 99.98% of the particle matter in the air. Those little crummy paper masks that you see the Japanese wearing remove about 10%. I brought my mask home, and we measured it at Worcester Poly, and it was radioactive. Well, I'm glad that stuff wound up in my mask and not in my lungs. So, my takeaway on wearing that mask is I wish I could buy thousands more and give them to the Japanese because they need them. They're there 24/7, 365, and they need them much more than I did.
Arne Gunderson, I do appreciate your taking the time to talk to us. I hope you can make the time to share your unique insights with us again as the situation in Japan continues to develop. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We've been speaking with Arne Gunderson, former nuclear industry executive and engineer and one of the directors of Fairwinds Energy Education. You can read and listen more of Mr. Gunderson's informative articles and podcast by visiting the site Fairwinds, fairewinds.org.
We'll have more of our special programming around the 6th anniversary of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster when we discuss with Dr. Peter Kuznick the history of Japan's paradoxical embrace of nuclear energy. We hope you'll join us then. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.